This podcast is brought to you by Harry's. Please visit harrys.com and use the promo code GOT to get $5 off your starter kit. Welcome to the Game of Thrones podcast, the officially unofficial podcast for Game of Thrones on HBO. I'm Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
And today we're talking about Season 5, Episode 8, entitled Hard Home. We kind of talked about the battle, mostly, I think, right. During the instant cast.
Completely forgot to talk about Arya.
We did. We totally spaced it. So having seen it twice, what do you think about it now?
I think it holds up. It's okay. It reminds me a lot of the Battle of the Blackwater, or Blackwater that way, and that, that felt like watching a really good action movie. This wasn't it wasn't like the whole thing was about this, but I thought it was appropriate. I don't know that you could have staged the whole thing to last an episode, but they packed as much action into 20 or 30 minutes as Blackwater did in an hour.
Yeah, so, felt like a Transformers movie. where the last half is just all action.
Okay, I was gonna say you gotta be careful.
sure
making that kind of comparison.
I'll qualify that it was much better than a Transformers movie. I never wanted out of the action. But there was some other stuff, a lot of other stuff happening at the beginning of this episode. We jumped around to several different plots here. I don't know what else you want to say before we get into the recap, but
Just reminding to everybody that Miguel Sapochnik was the director. He directed last episode too, and I gotta say, I didn't see anything in his resume that really jumped out that says this guy is going to be just a badass director of intense, wide scale. Is this the biggest, non Band of Brothers war scene that we've seen on television?
Man, it might be.
I mean, I can think of some really crazy shit that went on during the Dominion War of Star Trek.
That's true.
That was,
but
like,
space battles seem inherently easier.
Yeah,
honestly.
Like you throw 70 starships on the screen and it seems like it's epic, but we're talking thousands and thousands of digital creations and set composites.
Interacting
and live
with humans too.
Seamlessly.
That's the thing. Yeah.
Like, I was really the thing that really got me on the second watch was when Jon just cleaved that one. White into, and it just looked really convincing. I thought it was just amazing, and the only thing he did direct Repo Man, which was the Jude Law kind of sci-fi thriller from 2010. Mm-hmm. But nothing like on this scale, but I don't know, the maybe his storyboard background with Trainspotting helped him out, and he's just able to get all this out on the paper. It's written by the Double D's, David Benioff and Daniel Weiss.
It's not surprising.
Do you think, I've been thinking about these last three episodes and how they've been kind of restless feeling, and I want to set aside people's problems with like particular things like Sansa and maybe Dany's decisions and all that. I just think from a pacing standpoint, do you think this episode would have had this big of impact if we had just come off of climax after climax after climax, or if there had been, if we got to this like in episode 6?
Interesting. You're saying we needed a lull in the action from season 4 till now?
I've been thinking about it, because the other show I'm watching right now is Penny Dreadful, and it seems to do a pattern of like, hammer episode and then 2 to 3 very slow moving, almost like what the fuck is even happening, and it does build a tension and a restlessness, and sometimes that's you're cognizant of it and it works, sometimes you're cognizant of it and it doesn't work, it's like it's more impatient.
But I would say a couple of episodes ago this wasn't working for me. I was starting to get a little too restless.
Does this make up for the previous three?
No, not completely.
Okay. Do you think
and I'm not saying the last few were bad.
Right.
I just wanted something else to happen.
Do you think that this is the best episode of this show, of this series?
No.
I mean, I'm not going to say season, but series.
No.
What's better?
I don't think so. I personally like Blackwater better because
really
it had more emotion in it for me. Like Jon Snow was, I don't know, this felt scary, but it didn't feel like the stakes were all that high, whereas like Tyrion fighting off like making a stand at King's Landing felt like an epic thing. Like if he doesn't pull this off, everyone in this city is dead. Whereas we know, like, yeah, a lot of people died at this battle, certainly, and probably more than died at Blackwater, but a lot of people got away and there wasn't this sense of urgency, like, this is it, we have nowhere to run.
Did you think that Jon Snow could die?
Yeah.
I thought Jon Snow could die.
Sure, and when he gets his ass handed to him by the White Walker at first, I was a little scared because he's spitting up blood, he's in bad shape there for a second.
The other thing I want to talk about before we get into the episode proper is the public service announcement. This is something we do every fucking season.
Okay.
The concept of whites, W-I-G-H-T, versus White Walkers.
All right.
And I think we even got a little confused in a discussion at the end, not intentionally so, but the whites are the skeletons or undead creatures with blue eyes.
Yeah.
That are controlled in some fashion by the White Walkers, which are the gaunt, kind of desiccated looking dudes with flowing white hair, or they got an ice crown and they got the black armor and the ice spears. Well, I mean, we saw, I believe, 13 of them in the
when they froze the baby. Yeah.
And we've seen several more get dispatched over the years. And so I don't know. No one knows how much there are. Like, very little of what happened in this episode happens in the books.
Okay. I was going to ask about the lore of these guys. Like, so is there, like, are these four guys up on this clifftop significant? Do they have a lore? Like, are they former kings who were stricken down by the wheel or something?
I'm just curious. Something I'm struggling with is when to start putting some of this lore into, or not even lore, like speculation, because, you know, you are essentially caught up, like, there's, with very few exceptions, we are like 97% caught up to where we are in the books.
Okay.
And there is a lot of speculation in the book universe that just centers on assimilating stuff we already know and then extrapolating on it and making theories to see what happens. I mean, so at what point does that start to be fair game for television show watchers?
I know. Probably about now, I'd guess.
But if the show hasn't, if they mention, like, legends and whatnot in the books that are not mentioned in a television show, is that a book spoiler? Or is that just, like...
I mean, that's the thing. Like, I watched the thing that says, hey, here's how we made this episode and a little bit about it. And they were talking about this White Walker attack. And apparently Hardhome is, like, casually mentioned and just, like, this battle never happens with Jon Snow in it.
No, yeah, Jon's on
that. There's a battle that's talked about, but you never see it in the books. Like, yeah,
it's kind of you get like a very disjointed play by play from, like, ravens that Jon's getting at the wall of what's going on and stuff like that. And you can intimate a lot of what happened in this episode, but you know, for example, the fact that Valyrian Steel can stop a White Walker.
Yeah.
Is not book knowledge.
Really?
That's been speculated because it makes sense. You got obsidian dragon glass and its connection to, like, you know, things that are deep of the earth and molten, and then this Valyrian steel is sometimes called dragon steel, and no one knows how to make it, but it came from Valyria, land of the dragons. Maybe it was forged by dragonfire, maybe it was forged in the crack of doom or whatever, but
yeah,
that was something that's just speculation and now it's been confirmed. So it's like, you know, the television show is already spoiling the books.
There you go.
So I'm fine with it.
I think speculation is almost just completely unleashed here.
Right. Now, the thing that kind of blurs the whole whites, because you can't say that the whites in this universe are just mindless zombies, because even in the show, they've mentioned that there are echoes, like they have some access to their memories. For example, the Black Brothers they brought back and reanimated knew where the Lord Commander was and went right to his quarters. So to what extent that is something that they're acting on of their own free will, or to what extent that they get assimilated to a hive mind, like a Borg, no one knows. But there is some it's kind of dangerous because it's not just of manpower. They also get some kind of military intelligence from the people they assimilate.
Interesting.
Not even mildly. Wildly interesting.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting, considering they got a lot of people who John talked to about his plans this episode.
Maybe I can use that term for things that are TV spoilers for the books. They're wildly interesting.
Okay, I like it. All right, let's get into the recap.
Let's do it.
Discover why critics are calling Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes the best film of the franchise.
What a wonderful day!
It's a jaw-dropping spectacle that demands to be seen on the biggest screen possible.
We need to go.
Hang on.
It is our time.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes, now playing only in theaters. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
Tyrion and Jorah are brought before Dany, and Tyrion tries to convince her to make him her advisor and gives her a little bit of let's call it a demo of his capabilities here in judging Jorah, which causes her to banish him instead of killing him. So kind of a good thing for Jorah.
Rebanished.
Yeah. I mean, it's banishment number two. Three strikes and you're out. He's going to try to go back in later on, but we'll get there.
I like how Tyrion started to actually physically move away from Jorah and towards Dany.
Yeah.
Like, just going to start, you know, separating myself. And also, Jorah did not say one word after he was commanded not to speak in his own defense.
Yeah.
I thought that was interesting that, you know, I don't know if that's a desperate show of loyalty or...
It seems to be the Jorah way. Like, when the slavers pick them up, mm-hmm. Tyrion's just doing all the talking and, like, Jorah's just like,
okay, see where
this goes. I think
he wanted to say stuff, but he wanted to... I don't know. He just seems very desperate to get back in her good graces, and he's smart enough to know that, you know, her banging the gavel and be like, silence, silence, contempt of court, was not going to get him anywhere.
Yeah. I especially appreciate the line where he says, ruler who kills those who are devoted to her is not a ruler who inspires devotion. You're going to need devotion going forward. I think that's, you know, I speculated that Tyrion was going to come to Dany and try and be an advisor. That's exactly what happened here, and I think she's going to do well to have him in her,
sure,
her council.
Some questions about Jorah here. Does it look like the grayscale is getting worse to you? I couldn't really tell.
Not really. Maybe it's spreading like a tiny bit.
Yeah. When they showed that, it's like it's roughly the same size and shape. It's in roughly the same area. It's not like if I was wanting to show progression, it would be like wrist to elbow.
Yeah.
So do you... Are they hinting that this might be a Shireen situation? Because everybody thinks that he's on a ticking clock.
Yeah.
But could this be one of the rare cases that stabilize?
It could be.
That why Shireen is in the story to kind of give us
An anchor for Jorah?
Like, hey, this can happen. Like, it's a roundabout way of showing that maybe we shouldn't be surprised if he dies or he doesn't.
Yeah,
die,
and it's something where, you know, he doesn't have to go on this long journey to try and find a cure and all this stuff that Stannis has already done.
Right.
For Grayscale, it can just be he's kind of immune to it, you know.
And also, you know, Stannis brought in like tons of people. It's just as likely that none of that was effective.
Yep.
I mean, that's ancient medicine in a nutshell. You throw some shit and honey on it.
Put some leeches on them.
And if your body can fight off the illness, then it's going to fight off. If not, then hey, guess what? Honey and shit is like an amazing, amazing cold and flu remedy.
Yeah.
So yeah. I kind of think that, you know, it's not a lot of people fixated on the like, or maybe they'll bring a bunch of, I don't know, man. The way ancient medicine works, it's just a lot of witchcraft and placebo.
Yeah, definitely. I think the interesting thing about it is what are Jorah's motivations here? I mean, of course he loves Dany, but if he thinks that this grayscale is going to kill him, what's the point? You know?
Also, that's interesting. He went from looking at his disfigured like arm, and then he looked up, and there's just this row of all those harpy faces that look like they had been disfigured. Huh. Like their faces have been pulled off. And I was trying to think, that seems thematic of something, but I'm not sure what.
I don't know. I don't know either.
All right.
Anyway, let's go to Cersei. She's in the dungeon, and I don't know what you call these women. They're nuns in the Catholic
Church.
They're
septas. What? You got septuns?
Septas?
Septas.
Okay.
Yes.
A septa with water demands that she confess.
I love the septa.
Why?
I don't. There's something about her big, giant, impassive face that's like really intimidating.
Okay.
Like, if you wanted to design a woman that can physically intimidate Cersei and not give a shit about her threats, you would create this woman and shove her in a habit.
I mean, I feel like this is the quintessential Catholic school teacher with the ruler who's slapping people on the wrist.
But she's not old. And
no, but, you know, that outfit makes you look old.
I guess.
Regardless of how young you are, when you put that on, you age 40 years.
I don't know. It's almost like she wears, like, a suit of armor. It's impressive as, like, Brienne in her armor. in some like physically imposing way. And she also could be really tall. I didn't look up the actress to see that, but there was something about her that I found, it's one of those things where it's like, it's the battle of the assholes. I really hate Cersei. I really hate religious fanatics.
Yeah.
You know,
who do you want to see win?
Best
in this
case
situation?
Scenario, they all lose somehow. They find a way to do that. But I did like her individually.
Yeah.
And I think she's interesting.
Cersei didn't like her much. No. She threatens her with death and then she leaves without giving her any water. And then we head over to Arya, who we didn't talk about in the instant cast.
It's a hell of an episode when Arya is the most forgettable part.
And there's some real development in her story, too. No. And it's like, I don't fucking understand what this insurance salesman is.
Okay,
like,
I got it. I actually watched the scene a bunch of times.
How many times did you rewind to figure this thing out? I feel like this is a case of bad writing. They don't do enough to make a trail to where you need to go to understand who this guy is, why he's a problem, and why they would want to kill him.
I think it's one of those cases where the flowery Jack and kind of Yoda speak let him down.
Like, yeah.
He's way too up his own ass of hyperbole. And
a man
it all
has
makes
a potion for a girl.
Yes.
It should maybe do a thing. It's fucking
a girl puts
hard
the potion in the basket. Or the girl gets the hose. Yes, I'm with you. I think I understand.
So what is actually, can you explain this scene to me?
Okay. So this guy he's an insurance agent and he insures captains.
I got that part.
And apparently he also fucks over like occasionally when the claimant comes back and the captain is dead and the claimant is essentially weak and powerless. He welches on the deal.
Wait. Okay. So the guy who comes to him and gets carted off and says,
different.
What about my family? Okay. What about my kids?
This is that's the thing that I don't.
He tries to give him money. Like, all of this is very confusing. That's not a typical insurance transaction at all.
But he assesses risk. And the key thing here, which I can't believe, this is the thing that I thought was kind of bullshit. The guy's looking over his documents. He's like, I've been on 8 voyages.
Yeah.
I've returned without a scratch on me. But if you look, he's plotted a course on these maps through the smoking seas, through the devastation of
Valyria?
Valyria.
Oh.
And I think you're supposed to understand, but to expect the vast majority of show watchers, I think, are going to watch that scene and think this is some kind of scam, when I think it's evidence of him just weighing the risk and be like, No.
Okay.
It's like you
want to.
But
now, why do they want to kill him? Why do the faceless men want to kill him?
For a totally unrelated reason that he's actually an asshole.
Oh my God. See, that's super confusing.
I agree.
To show me something and then say this is unrelated to what we're about to do.
I agree.
Is foolish, I think.
Because I think you're trying to draw the connection, and I don't know why they showed it that way. And if they meant. Because again, the only reason. If he's just a guy saying, this is too risky for me, I'm not taking your money, that's not immoral. That's not unethical.
Sure.
That's what an insurance thing is all about.
Exactly. So why kill him?
But
apparently there's another reason. Like,
he
eats too many oysters or something. I don't know.
No, I mean, the reason is that he has screwed over widows and orphans when he feels like he can get away with it.
See, I thought that that's what he was doing to this guy.
But it doesn't make sense, because you have to get the money before you can screw.
Exactly. So I was super confused. Okay,
now,
that makes way more sense.
I almost wonder if we're going to find out in another episode, maybe the next episode, as the girl continues to see that what he's really doing is trying to extort even more money from him. Like, I'm, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, whatever. I think you could pay. So he's going to get more money up front and screw him over even harder, because this guy is
so
desperate and he's doing something he knows is dangerous. So, but then again, that's still kind of poor writing to confuse someone in an episode and then clear it up later.
Yeah, I agree.
But yeah.
Did not like that scene whatsoever, except for I liked seeing Arya on the job. You know, that was pretty cool. Although I got to say, you got a hall full of faces. Arya doesn't get one. They are face hogs. They really are, man.
They're you gotta get your learner's permit.
You gotta earn the face.
You gotta, you know, if like what if you put you in a, if you put you in a fancy face and you can't pull off the acting, then
good
you're
point.
Wasting a face. So it's like, can you convincingly play essentially, you know, a different version of yourself? And if you can't.
Yeah. You don't want to waste a face. I gotcha.
What do you think's going on with the little blonde waify girl that's always naysaying Arya? Like, what is it? What does she give a shit? Like, I think Jacken's got the right view of it. Like, if she fails, she'll die. Maybe that guy die will too. We worship death. What is your problem?
Yeah, I don't know. I thought there was some...
She doesn't care if she dies. This thin man we decide needs to die for whatever reason. If they both die, then all well and good.
It feels like maybe jealousy. Like, I don't know that this girl has ever been through the door to see the Hall of Faces.
But she's way better than Arya in a lot of extent.
She is, yeah.
And she knows a lot more. So it's like, why did she stall out in her training?
I don't know.
Yeah.
But that's the idea I get, that she's jealous and wants to know more about why Arya succeeded and why she's being given the position instead of her.
Yeah, I wasn't. That's one thing that I think we're going to have to wait and see.
Yeah. The other thing I noticed in the scene is as Arya walks away with this potion to kill this insurance salesman.
Yeah.
She's smiling.
Sure.
That can't be a good sign, right? I mean, she wants to kill. She wants to go out there and have a little blood on her hands.
Yeah.
Is that?
I don't know.
Don't forget that Needle is still out there, right? Like,
sure.
What's she going to do with Needle?
Sure.
She's pretty invested in this faceless man thing now.
Yeah. There's still a lot of this that's still left to go in the book. So I'm pulling back a bit on this, but, I think you're supposed to be wondering about that. And to me, I think her bearing Needle is just her not being able to fully get rid of Arya. And what does that imply for her training as a faceless man?
Yeah. And that smile to me says she's more about her list than she is the faceless men.
But this has nothing. The chilling thing is this has nothing to do with her list.
I know.
But it
gives her some practice with killing. Right. Like, that's the scary thing.
No, I mean, we talked about this last season. It's kind of fucked up. As much as we think it's cool and we are rooting for her to become this killer, it's fucked up that this little girl we saw in season one is now delighted about the prospect of killing someone.
Yeah.
That she doesn't even know. That's the thing. She also accepts on blind faith that what she's being told is true. Mm-hmm. When she herself has taken place in a part of a deception to kill someone before. Like, are we supposed to draw parallels between her lie that she told the little girl and what Jacken is telling her? Is she being manipulated?
Could be. That's interesting. Qyburn comes to see Cersei in the dungeons. He tells her there's no chance she's going to win this trial. Tommen's despondent. He's not seeing anybody. He then urges her to confess. And she says, of course, that she won't.
Yeah.
Especially not to that man.
Yeah.
You know, the High Sparrow, who is a barefooted commoner, her opinion.
No word from Jaime. That was kind of significant. And also, Maester Pycelle has done a hostile takeover of the Small Council.
But Kevin Lannister has been called in, right? To be the hand of the king and to take over the Small Council?
Well, I would think so. I think the Hand is like the senior official. He's like the chairman of the board. So
Pycelle's got it for a little bit, but...
Right. He's running roughshod, and he's like... So this is a big gamble. If Cersei does get out of the dungeons, like, she is threatening everyone... Pycelle is going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, you would think so.
So when Qyburn says the work is proceeding or the work continues.
The mountain, baby.
Okay. You're all in on the mountain theory.
Oh yeah. The mountain's going to rage through those dungeons and
one
snatch
man
up,
army?
Snatch
one man
up
army
Cersei.
Style?
Yep. In his meaty paws.
I have to admit, it would be super satisfying to see him wading through the faith militant.
It totally would be.
They're just banging on him with hammers and he's just hulking out.
Yeah, I'd love that.
Because he was a monster in life. If he's some kind of Frankenstein, Qyburnstein's monster, then watch the fuck out, man.
So we go back to Sansa, who is brought food by Reek, and she starts badgering him about killing her brothers, and Reek eventually confesses he didn't kill her brothers, he killed two rando farm boys instead.
Right.
Okay, and then he scuttles off. I mean, he's going to have to come back for food later, right? So she's just going to continue this cycle of browbeating him until she gets what she wants, apparently.
It seems foolish of Ramsay to give Reek this job.
I think he's a little full of himself.
And it also seems foolish. Do you think that Ramsay will take Reek on with him on his raiding party? Because if he leaves Reek there with Sansa... unsupervised for potentially weeks on end,
yeah,
with possible the chance of him dying in combat. In fact, man, it seems very probable that he'll die in combat. That, I mean, it seems almost too obvious that Reek and Sansa are going to eventually reconcile and somehow.
I think you're right.
Brienne team. I mean, I think we've been thinking Stannis, but it's going to be Reek, Sansa, Brienne.
And Podrick, yeah.
And Podrick.
Okay, I like that combo.
The four musketeers.
Yeah, and they'll go, I hope, on the search for Bran and Rickon.
So I've thought about this a lot because we questioned about what this scene means other than that. And I got, you know, got a lot of feedback on it and there's stuff on the forums. And I think that there's a couple of reasons that this is significant. Number one, it's a shot in the arm for Sansa. You thought you were the last living Stark, real Stark, because Jon doesn't count. Surprise, you actually have, you know, some brothers still alive.
Yeah.
So it's just the first good news she's gotten in since she thought maybe she's going to get married to Loras, which wasn't the good news she thought.
What about Arya? She doesn't care about Arya?
I think she thinks Arya's dead.
Really? I mean Brienne
why would
told
you
her.
Think...
Brienne told Littlefinger and her pub that she's alive.
That's right. Okay.
So this is yet another bolstering for Sansa,
another
right?
shot in the arm for her. Also,
she needs it. She really needs it at this point.
Also, like we alluded to in the instant cast, it's a secession issue. Like, you know, as long as Bran or Rickon are still alive, then the Boltons can do whatever they want. They're not the rightful heirs to Winterfell.
Hmm. Okay.
So all they have to do is survive, grow into men, get an army, and the North will remember and rally around them.
As we've seen that, it's pretty easy. Dany's done it.
Sure, sure. So there is some potential, and maybe, you know, I think Sansa's smart enough to realize how that stuff works. So maybe this recalibrates the game she's playing, or at least makes it easier to bear what she's having to bear. That, like, if this is now a waiting game, like, I can see some lights at the end of the tunnel, and hopefully they're not a fucking George Martin Express train coming at me.
Yeah, that's a possibility. But also, it seems like her history has prepared her for this, right?
Also, this is crucially something that Littlefinger cannot possibly know.
That's true.
So all of his plans...
Literally no one knows this except for Reek and now Sansa, right?
Well, I think Ramsay and Roose know it. So I guess it's not impossible for Littlefinger not to
Pretty
know.
Much impossible.
But if Littlefinger fucking doesn't know that Ramsay is a sadistic asshole, then I'm going to say he doesn't know about Bran and Rickon.
Okay.
And
it's fair.
Anytime he's trying to climb the ladder of chaos, imprecise, incorrect information might be the thing to bring him down.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah, it could. Interesting. Well, Roose and Ramsay are trying to bring down Stannis, and they're talking about their strategy for that. Roose wants to make this a siege, which seems smart, you know?
Sure.
If he's got the castle and the food and the winter weather gear, why not?
Yeah.
But Ramsay, he likes to fight, and he decides, I want to take it to Stannis with 20 good men. What do you think? What's going on here?
I don't know. I mean, Ramsay is very tricksy.
He is.
In the Smeagol Gollum sense of the word. I feel like that he could pose as a northern lord, as he's, you know, posed as a ironborn to trick Theon. You know, imagine, so he rides in with his 20 men wearing Stark armor, because I'm sure they got a shit ton of it.
Okay.
And he says, the North remembers, and I know that Bran and Rickon are still alive, and also Sansa is being held hostage in Winterfell. Mm-hmm. Stannis probably is going to, I mean, that's a lot of good faith evidence that you can trust this person.
I think so.
Now, how you parlay that into killing 6,000 men is another question.
That's the tricky thing. Like, what can 20 men do that one man couldn't do? That's where I wonder, like, specifically about that number 20. Like, if he was to say, I need 500 good men, you get away with that.
20 guys with torches, how many tents can they set on fire? And if you burn, like, it could be as simple as, like, I'm going to kill as many as I can and burn all their shelters, and it's the fucking middle of winter, and they're going to die.
That'll kill the rest, yeah.
It could be something like that, but it's not going to be straightforward, like... Ninja Gaiden shit. Like, there's, it's not going to be 20 on 6. Like I said, it's 300 men per dude.
Yeah.
That's not good odds.
Not at all.
No.
Yeah, I'm curious. I don't have any good prediction on what's going to happen with Ramsay there.
But he did work the title of a book in. I think
it's
the first time since Game of Thrones. So there you go.
All right, we go back over to Tyrion and Dany, who are drinking.
Which I guess I should mention, it's Feast for Crows. I don't know if like the majority of show watchers know all the titles. So yeah, when he said that he leaves a Feast for Crows, that's actually the name of the fourth book in the series.
Yeah, I guess I hadn't considered that people might not know that.
Yeah.
Tyrion and Dany are drinking wine together. They discuss their families. They discuss Varys, how to get Dany on the Iron Throne, all sorts of stuff. Tyrion suggests she doesn't have the support she needs to take the throne. And Dany says, I don't care. I'm not here to stop the wheel. I'm here to break the wheel.
So Tyrion saying her decisions are wise and impressive. Is that the double D's trying to convince us?
I think so. Yeah.
Well, look, do you like Tyrion? Tyrion's a smart guy. He thinks this is all amazing. Oh, okay. Yeah.
I feel a little validated because I'm like, well, I think Dany's plan is this. And then Tyrion says, that's her plan, and that's smart. So I'm like, okay.
And I'm not debating. I actually think I kind of am sympathetic. I think the way it was shown was curiously rushed, considering, like, I'm thinking, well, maybe this is going to be, there's just too much stuff. But now that I've seen the other three episodes, I'm like, I think you could have spent another episode developing that and making it seem a bit more natural. But whatever.
Yeah, maybe so.
So he also recontextualizes Varys for her.
Yep.
You know, do you buy that?
That he, even though he was the man on the hunt for her, that he might have also been the man protecting her?
It makes a lot of sense because, yes, you know, Viserys and her were, I mean, he was like an 8-year-old kid and she was a newborn when they first came to Essos. They single-handedly evaded all these paid assassins and soldiers.
Yeah.
Like, it does make good sense. But on the other hand, we really don't know if Varys is trustworthy and what his, we know what he says. We know
That's
what
true.
He's always said. It's for the realm. It's for the realm. It's for the realm.
That's true.
But yeah, like,
and get this, Tyrion trusts Jaime at this point.
That is a crucial point that I want to talk about. Yep.
So are we to assume that his mistaken trust there is also the same that he has in Varys?
Could be.
Cause we know how Jaime feels about Tyrion.
Yep.
Jaime wants to kill him.
Yeah, I think, and I think that's got to be significant later. That if
ever
meet, they're
he's going to go in for the handshake and he's going to lose his hand.
yeah. How's it feel, fucker? Also, I got like a Tom Hagen, Sonny Corleone vibe that like he's spending all this time trying to talk her out of what she wants and away from the fire and blood. And I do think there's going to be, you know, damn it, I wish I had a Sicilian for this kind of shit. The moment, like, that he's going to find himself out if he doesn't start telling her how to win. Or do you think he'll just, like, as a good advisor, I have to say that here's a possible, you know, I'm going to give you every possible avenue of how you can be a ruler. And
That doesn't seem like Tyrion's style, frankly.
Okay.
I think Tyrion presents the case that he believes is right.
Okay.
Whether that's right or not.
The other interesting thing about the scene is that she very conspicuously cuts him off the wine.
Yeah.
And
he
kind of seems like, oh, okay. Like for the first time, yeah, maybe I need to rethink the drinking myself to death strategy.
Well, he never had anything to live for before, right?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
The best he could do was be shit on by his father.
Sure.
And protected to the point where Cersei wasn't allowed to kill him. And that's about it.
Yeah.
Now he's got a real shot at, helping someone come to power who's going to make a difference.
Yeah, this isn't being in charge of the sewers at Lannisport. This is like real power. I also, when he mentions his analysis of the great houses, do you know what house is conspicuously absent?
No.
Dorne.
Wow, no respect for Dorne, huh?
Well, it's interesting because Dorne, Oberyn's sister was married to the prince who was going to be the next king. I mean, they're probably the tightest of the Targaryen loyalists, and yet Tyrion doesn't mention that.
Does not mention
Dorne. He mentions the Starks. He mentions the Lannisters. He mentions the Tyrells.
Martells?
No, he mentions the Tyrells. The Martells are the Dorne the house.
Yeah. He doesn't mention them at all.
Yeah, and I wonder if that is an oversight on his part, something that the double D's are trying to tell us. Or something that they're not trying to tell us.
That's interesting. Okay. I don't know what it means, but
I don't either.
It's surprising.
I don't either.
Given that Marcella's down there and I'm sure Tyrion knows that.
Well, he put her down there. Fuck yeah, he knows.
Yeah.
So
I don't know why he doesn't mention them.
Yeah. And I'd say that it's like surefire has to mean something, except for, you know, you get the insurance, the thin man, and like that just doesn't make sense. So it's like it could just be another, you know, adaptation problem.
Yeah. Just an oversight.
Yeah.
Maybe.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live. Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Our coverage of Hot D, Fire and Blood, and the 1980s Shogun miniseries continues. But then on Tuesday, for the first time in 35 years, we asked a question. Who framed Roger Rabbit? Hop aboard the train to Toontown as we revisit this incredible blending of live action and animation to see if it still holds up all this time later.
Then on Wednesday, we get our first look at Blake Crouch's mind-bending sci-fi series, Dark Matter. The first two episodes drop simultaneously on Apple TV Plus, and we'll have a pair of podcasts quantumly linked ready for you to observe.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
I don't know. Let's go over to Jorah. He's back. He's back again. He's not content to sit outside the city and die. He goes to the slaver who bought him, brought him to the pits, asks to fight again at the Great Games in exchange for his freedom, and he gives away his freedom in order for this guy to bring him to the Great Games.
But what does that even mean?
I know, because he just reclaimed his freedom moments ago.
If I need my freedom, I'll punch you again. You'll know I have my freedom back when your nose is bleeding and you're in the dirt. That's how you'll know.
And pray that it's only that.
And I'll take this coin again. Thank you very much.
He seems to agree. We don't get any more of that this episode.
Do you think, I just realized something.
Huh.
Do you think that flipping, because like we saw him give Tyrion a coin, and we thought it was just kind of like a cruel joke, but maybe that's the cloak. Maybe that's the fig leaf covering the giant hairy dick of slavery, is that, no, these aren't slaves. We paid them. Because Jorah has a coin, he flips it back at him.
Yeah, you're right. You're right.
So I kind of wonder
if I'm a slave again.
If this is like this is straight up just a technicality, so that all the papers are in order.
Yeah, it could be,
and that the men were all paid, but it's all bullshit.
Okay, so we don't see the coin that he hands Jorah, but we do see the one he hands Tyrion, and then this one that Jorah flips back is his own.
This is something I just made up on the spot, so I haven't really thought it through. But I you know,
it seems to make sense.
It would, and I kind of wish they'd made a bigger point of it, but
yeah. Okay.
Because
cool.
It doesn't say that, you know, they're free to go, but they're under contract. I paid him a whole quarter. You know, the gruel and the hovel they live in costs money. It's, you know, when they're off contract.
They can buy an oyster with that, probably.
Sure, with vinegar even.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's
yeah.
living. That's life.
A lot of vinegar. A shitload of vinegar. She just dumps vinegar on those things.
Mm.
Anyway, the nun's back in
I want to talk about his motivations, though, real quick, because I'm trying to consolidate, because we broke Bald Move records for feedback, which is saying a lot. So I'm having to consolidate a lot of thoughts and stuff to get him out there. Some people talked about that he could just be suicidal because he thinks he's going to die anyway because of Grayscale. So might as well go out. He's a warrior. Might as well go out with your boots on.
He wants to kill the queen.
It could be.
I seriously doubt it.
It could be, though, that he wants. I mean, if he's acting like out of revenge, maybe he is trying to spread Grayscale as far as he can. Like, I'm gonna rub every slave I can.
That could be his weapon. Like, he goes into the Great Games and he just pulls up his sleeve. Aha! Aha! What are you gonna do now, fucker?
It's Brock's hand grenade from Anchorman. He just runs around with his forearm screaming.
I don't remember that. Yeah,
really?
No.
He's just running around with a hand grenade, and he's just running through that big fight going, ah!
All right, so if you kill him, he lets go. And
there you go.
Yeah.
And that could also tie in with him looking at the harpies and seeing disfigured, and he's like, maybe it's like, I'll show these people. I'll show them all.
Okay.
I mean, that's kind of a dark motivation for him. And then there's also the thought I had in the instant cast, which I'm still liking, that maybe he wants to be a whistleblower.
For slavery, yeah.
You, through no fault of your own, were a part of a big atrocity level of evil, mm-hmm. and it's the exact same thing for me, and how can you judge me, and blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
So
the other possibility, what if he wants to try to help Danny out by resolving this Sons of the Harpy situation? It seems like it's mostly resolved at
this
point.
How does he even fucking know about the Sons of the Harpy situation? He's been gone this whole time.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah. Okay. Never mind.
No, I mean, I didn't mean to shut you down.
Right.
Okay.
No, you're right.
But if he does, let's say he's reading Essos Quarterly and headlines are about the Sons of Harpy.
Uh-huh.
Where were you going with that? How is he going to help stop them? Because also,
he could go
stopped.
On a killing rampage. Yeah, that's the thing. They have stopped, it seems.
They've gone underground.
After she married Hisdar.
Suspicious that.
Yeah.
Still suspicious.
We'll see how it goes. So the nun's back in Cersei's cell, the Septa. When Cersei threatens her again, she pours water onto the floor and she leaves, and then Cersei sucks the water off the ground. I really got a kick out of seeing that.
Sure.
You know, that dungeon floor has not been cleaned in a while.
No.
And I mean, where else are you going to piss and shit but on the dungeon floor?
There you go. Well, if it's good enough for Bear Grylls, it's good enough for Cersei. Are you feeling sorry for Cersei yet?
A little bit.
Really?
Just the tiniest bit, yeah.
I'm not there at all.
No, she deserves everything she's getting, but...
Like, I eventually got there with Even Theon.
Yeah.
Like, I was like, okay. This is a bit much.
Yeah.
But Cersei, she hasn't really experienced the consequence yet. And they're all of her own devise. Like, the fact that...
You're right about that.
You know, she's done all this to make her son secure and to protect him from the influence of the tyrant. Well, now he is starving himself in his room and she can do shit and he's being puppeted by people she doesn't trust. And she could get out. I mean, it seems like that she could get out of this by confessing. Or what do you mean? What do you think they mean by confess? Like, confess would get you a mouthful of water. What else would it get you? Like, Lancel did everything that she did, and he is not put to death, and he didn't, I don't even think
but
he had to
part of this cult. So, he's like, part do of the you cult, have to...
But he wasn't, like, carved star in your head part of the cult. Like, I think there are...
Lancel?
Yeah. I mean, he is now, but I'm saying, you know, when he first put on the robes, I think begging for mercy and forgiveness, like, what is the next step? And I'm wondering, I mean, it seems like the way they're putting on the show is she's not afraid of death. It's her pride keeping her in this prison.
Yeah. Yeah, I think you're right.
That's the other crucial thing where I'm not feeling too sorry for her, because her pride can be taken down a notch.
I completely agree. And I like when I say a little bit, I really mean just the tiniest bit. Feeling sorry for her. But I don't know. It's an interesting question of how much of her stuff will be forgiven. What will be the punishment if she does confess? We've talked about the political ramifications of it. Like, she's not going back to being queen if she confesses.
The other thing about Theon was a little complicated is he admitted that he was wrong. Like, even when he was being rescued by the fake Ramsay Northern, real Ramsay, fake Northern or fake Ironborn. He was saying like, Rob was my brother and I fucked him. I wish I could take it all back. So even before he got his dick lopped off, he was already kind of contrite, whereas Cersei is not contrite whatsoever.
Well, Jaime was her brother and she fucked him too. So there you go.
There's another case of Martin symmetry.
I don't know.
Beautiful poetry.
I don't know what goes on there, but we'll find out. Gilly's tending to Sam's wounds. Ollie comes in to check on Sam, bring him some food. He also has some questions about why John is saving the wildlings and why they're doing what they're doing. Sam tries to reason with him, says, hey, everyone is doing this stuff for the greater good. Tough decisions need to be made, but it seems to be too personal for Ollie. I don't know that he's totally sold on this yet.
There's a couple of key quotes here. One is, don't worry about John, he always comes back.
Oh, don't ever say that.
We saw how well that worked for the Wildling Mother this episode. Uh-huh. I'll be right there with you. You know, so this is exhibit A of why I was kind of terrified that Jon Snow was going to make it out of this episode.
Yeah.
The other thing that's interesting is sometimes a man has to make hard choices that might seem wrong to others, but you know it is right in the long run. That is, I'm not sure if it's something you say to an impressionable teenager.
Okay. Who has bloodlust in his heart?
What kind of decision might Ollie undertake thinking that everyone says it's wrong, but I know secretly it's in my heart right? That's some scary shit taken together.
Yeah. Now that's interesting. I don't know. I don't know what Ollie's role in this is, but clearly he has one. He's been too central of a character not to.
Also, he is sir not appearing in the books. So who the hell knows?
Okay, cool. So we go up to Hardhome.
Jon Snow's George Washington moment. He's crossing to the shivering Potomac.
Okay, yeah. He reaches Hardhome. Tormund tries to convince Lord of Bones to join him, but it doesn't go well, and he has to kill him to get a town hall meeting started. Like, he has to kill him to let the negotiations commence.
I love it, and it was so gratuitous. It was, like, read as comedy to me.
Okay, yeah.
Like, you know, we just did the Shaun of the Dead review, and, like, when they're synchronized beating on the zombie, it's like it kind of was that flavor for me.
Just needed a Queen song.
Yeah, yeah.
You would think that a guy with two skulls could take more of a beating. Is what I'm thinking.
It's interesting that this is a guy running around with a giant skull for a helmet in a camp that features a real giant.
Oh, yeah.
Like the political that's incendiary, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. Plus, I don't know. It seems like giant skulls will be bigger.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, that giant was huge.
It is, but their heads seem disproportionately small.
I don't know.
And I think there's a good reason for that.
Maybe it was a
They're
small
dudes
giant.
Wearing stilts, but still, it's like, I don't think it's like, you know,
okay,
necessarily means that their skulls are six times bigger just because they're six times taller. It seems like they kind of got a little bit of a, I wouldn't say pinhead, but a little bit of a pinhead.
I would never call a giant a pinhead.
Not to his face.
No. Maybe not even behind his back.
The fuck you looking at? Your pinhead?
Squash. So during this town hall meeting, John tells the wildlings that they can beat the White Walkers. He shows them a bag full of dragon glass that they're all oohing and aahing at.
Sure.
He also offers them land in the north if they help fight. And eventually he invokes their children in order to convince them to join him. But not all of them do. Actually, not many do.
This is the impassioned argument I wish John made to the Black Brothers.
Yeah.
Because I thought everything that I thought he should have said, he said in a very excellent, inspiring way, and I was very satisfied with
it. Yeah, essentially nothing else matters, you know?
Yeah, he got the Metallica song in the background.
He did.
Yeah.
I hate the fucking Thins.
I hate the fucking Thins, too. Everyone hates the Thins.
They do.
Although they did have... This guy went out with a little bit of a heroism.
He did.
Surprising enough. What'd you make of the legends of ice spiders big as hounds?
I don't know. I didn't pay any attention because the Thins didn't seem to. I know she comes back and says, like, after all you've seen, really. Yeah. But I
can't remember because
it doesn't matter.
In season one, it seems inconsequential. Old Nan tells something that tells a story that like makes Bran shit his pants about the long winter. And in the book, she clearly mentions ice spiders. And I can't remember if she did in the books or the shows or not, but now they got Legends of Ice Spiders. This is something we haven't seen in the books. Do you think it would be cool?
Cooler than White Walkers? Like, well, I just don't see, like, the point. Like, who cares if there are spiders bigger than hounds?
If they're ice spiders, why are they riding around undead horses? Ride around on your ice spiders, man. That's way cooler.
That would be way cooler. You're right.
So it's like, I kind of think this, you know, by the law of, maybe it's the law of conservation of coolness. They're keeping something in reserve.
But it can't be cooler. It cannot be cooler than the White Walkers.
I don't know. Like, I fucking hate spiders. I still to this day can't watch the scene where Shelob stings Frodo. Okay. Like, I have to physically, it makes me ill. I have to physically look away. I cannot watch the stinger or the bite or whatever the fuck happens.
That's a well-done spider.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm thinking an ice spider would be even more terrifying.
I don't know. I don't care. Like, it's so much easier to fight an ice spider than it is to fight an undead being.
Well, you'd think it'd be easier to shatter a fucking ice sword, but apparently not. You have to have a magical blade or some dragon glass or else.
That's what I mean.
Poof.
Like, the White Walkers are infinitely more scary to me.
Okay. And they are scarier. Like, I thought the first time we saw a White Walker and his face looking like a hat full of buttholes, I'm like, this is not reading scary. This reads kind of like homeless man chic.
Yeah.
This is not. But they are starting to get a little creepier.
They are. I don't know whether it's the whites are creepy. The White Walkers are not really.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Okay. I don't think they're all that creepy, but
I don't know. When that dude walked in,
they're powerful.
In
they're intimidating.
And he was, like, extinguishing the flames as he went. I was like, wow, this is pretty intense.
It was intense, no doubt. Let's talk about it. I mean, they're loading people onto boats here. The White Walkers attack, and during the battle, John kills one of the White Walker lieutenants with Longclaw. And he escapes on the boats and looks back while the leader of the White Walkers resurrects all their dead troops.
Yep. Saying, come at me, bro.
Yeah. This is a huge problem, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, how many people were up there? 60,000?
That said 60,000.
They said they got like $5,000 onto a boat.
So 55,000 plus Army of the Dead.
And they were already scared of the White Walkers.
They had
now
shit.
Add 55,000 more White Walkers or whites.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. So
that's
a couple things I want to take apart here. The giant's name is 1-1.
1-1. Did George Lucas name him? What's going on there?
He. You know, Obi-Wan's cool, but Obi-1-1's even cooler. I wondered because there is a giant character about this point in the books. Obviously it doesn't cut heart, but I was wondering if it's supposed to be the same guy, and then when Tormund shouts 1-1 to the sea is like, ah, yes. He also seemed very interested in the dragon glass.
Yeah,
but it didn't pay off.
Nope.
Like, or you, I was kind of surprised. I thought, like, man, a giant with, I don't think he needed it.
No, it didn't seem like it.
And I was because I don't know a lot about giants, I was like, man, how many whites does it take to overwhelm a giant? Like, can they actually do him damage? It didn't seem like I feel like he could take 100 of them on. No problem.
Maybe so.
Like, yeah. They can't swarm him faster than he can stomp them and smash them. And
yeah,
he's like these, like, it's too bad there's not more giants because damn.
Yeah, it felt like he could really just wade through as many as they could throw at him.
And that scene where he's carrying a giant tree trunk on fire and you just see him from the waist up just running behind and I think it's John and Ed and Tormund are running in front of him. I don't know why, but that scene just made me laugh out loud.
Yeah.
Because it was not awesome. Even like a laugh from like, this is absurd. It's like laugh that this is so cool.
Yes.
Like when you see a huge explosion, my reaction is always the laugh. It's not.
That's exactly how I felt when he stomped a couple of whites.
Yeah. Yeah.
He stomped them, and every time I laugh out loud.
A little bit of Ents from Lord of the Rings there. Yeah, so I'm surprised that the dragon glass didn't make it out. Akarsi, which is the wildling woman, and I'm not sure if that was actually mentioned. She's not. I don't think she's a character in the books. I was very impressed at how well-rounded and awesome they made her with like 15 minutes of screen time.
Yeah.
And then she died.
Yep.
I'm kind of curious about what the hell is going on with that. Because, you know, we played around with some ideas in Instant Cast, but I don't know.
Yeah, like how would it be meaningful to have her come back? You know, it doesn't seem like it would be yet. But it could be that they're setting up a long con here for a lot of things.
Jon Snow at some points in his battle says, I've given orders, they'll be obeyed even if I don't make it back. Do you buy that?
Damn. I don't know, man. 5,000
plus wildlings show up at the gates of Castle Black and want in. What's Alistair Thorne do?
I think he pulls a Thorne and says, nah.
Does the presence of Jon Snow change that?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a lot of respect for the command structure there, it seems.
Right.
That may be the only thing they respect, is the hierarchy.
Did you think that the imagery of the four White Walkers on the ridge was deliberately conjuring the concept of the four horsemen of the apocalypse?
This is the first thing I thought of.
Okay.
So, yeah, way. I think so.
Yeah. Like, this is the no-shit, Revelation-style apocalypse coming to you.
Yeah.
And you're worried about Cersei sucking water off the dungeon floor.
Yeah,
and
there's that.
Tyrion and Dany will get along.
You seem to have a very negative opinion on...
It's not negative.
...what goes on in the South not mattering at this point.
I don't think I can forget this.
Yeah.
So, like, I don't know whether I'm just going to just not care about it, but on the other hand... you know, we've gone since season two since we've seen a really large scale and nothing at this scale, like decimating 200 or so Rangers of the Night's Watch is nothing like completely gutting 60,000 wildlings in the space of minutes. So like it really
does.
Yeah, this
is more akin to Blackwater than than the Battle with the Wall.
Yeah, yeah. So I do think it's going to be, it's going to be hard to be invested. It's just going to be like, you know, there again, we only have two books, potentially two, maybe three seasons left. So maybe it is time for everybody in Westeros to catch up with this. And we're going to have a season of maybe people in denial versus people that have got the fever. And, you know, who's going to win? So maybe it won't be a problem because, you know.
Yeah, I mean, eventually they'll all lose if they don't get together.
Also, really like the touch of the giant wearing a mammoth rib cage for an armor. Did you notice that?
I noticed something he was wearing. Yeah,
I thought that was really the design. Interesting. I think that the wildlings are kind of boring. Like, I don't buy that the Thins, like all these various tribes, dress identically. Hmm. But some of the individual touches, like the Lord of Bones and what one was wearing, I thought was pretty cool.
Yeah.
So yeah. Now, on second viewing, and I actually went and compared, I'm positive. I don't think this was Khaleesi's children, obviously, because they made it onto the boat. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, the White Walkers chose not to pursue them across the water.
Yeah.
But I'm certain when they showed her two redheaded children in the boat, and then they showed the two, one older, one smaller redheaded children that were whites, they meant to imply that she was, for whatever reason... I don't think she hesitated because a lot of people were saying, oh, well, she's a mom and blah, blah, blah. I think it's more like, no, she thought these were her children, and that's what made her hesitate.
I think she might actually recognize these children.
That's not...
I think they might be dead, kids who died at Hardhome from possibly starvation,
because these are not,
some other diseases, anything.
I think some people are confused about, like, maybe when the White Walkers reanimate you, you instantly age into a zombie, but I think... The skeletonized zombies are very ancient, very old, and the recently turned ones are essentially like the Walking Dead zombies. They just they decay at a slower rate, whatever. I don't know, but
seems like it because there are people. Those are pretty fresh garb.
Those are pretty fresh wildling children. It seems.
I think so, and I want to say they're from Hardhome, kids who have died from there.
Could be.
I don't know. Anyway, I have a lot of stuff to talk about in this scene as well.
Oh yeah, I'm unloading. I want to talk about the zombie waterfall, the Niagara.
Okay, let's go.
The Canadian side Niagara of zombie waterfalls.
Oh, that's
the waterfall.
The most impressive side, yeah.
It's the waterfall for which all other zombie waterfalls must be judged.
Uh-huh.
Get ready, Walking Dead. Get ready. You start some weak-ass 1-2 zombies falling out of a second-story window, I'm going to call bullshit on that.
Yeah.
I'm coming for you, Nicotero. The bar's been raised.
Yeah, I did a little more thinking about that during my second viewing of this episode. And you're kind of right. I don't know. Aside from like a sea of walkers and making them more gruesome looking.
You've been saying that for years.
I know,
the mega herd.
I feel like Game of Thrones has given me more mega herd than I will ever see in Walking Dead.
Yeah. And I mean, like I said, it's the double D's flopping their junk out on the table. It's like, hey, our show's not even fucking about zombies. We're going to out-zombie you.
Yeah.
Kaboom.
It's kind of sad, honestly.
I'm sure that the Gimple and Nicotero will cry themselves asleep under 18 million viewers weekly watching it, but
yeah,
whatever.
For the next 12 years or however long it's on.
Okay. What's some of
Thoughts? So first of all, John doesn't do much to help his case when he's talking about Mance. He's like, I put an arrow through his heart.
Yeah, right.
And it takes Tormund to stand up and say, whoa, it was actually a mercy shot. Come on, guys.
I think that was a deliberate machination, though.
Like by the writers, yes, it was.
No, by John. It was a calculated, like, if I start equivocating, like, well, I killed him, but I kind of was a... Like, the Wildlings would be like, bullshit, but...
But Tormund could back him up, I mean...
And I think he was trusting that Tormund would. Like, I'm gonna say the absolute truth that's not flattering to me at all, and I'm gonna expect Tormund to back him. And if he fucks me, then...
Okay. He also goes in offering lands that I'm not sure he can offer. If Stannis doesn't win this battle, he definitely can't offer them lands.
All right. So this is a little... This is some book background.
Oh, boy.
But
oh,
there's
no.
Like... From the wall to 50 miles south along the entire stretch is called the Gift. And it was an ancient Stark King gave the Night's Watch all this land to basically do as they said. Back in the days when the Night's Watch were 1,000 strong and they fully garrisoned 13 castles and they had stewards that farmed the land and did all that. And they were kind of self-sufficient fighting force. So... It isn't. I think it's legally within the Lord Commander's right to do whatever the hell he wants with that land.
Okay.
That it's sovereign Night's Watch territory.
All right. Yeah, that's not in the show at all. So I was confused.
I think they mentioned it, but it was a very offhand, like, you know, we can settle them in the Gift or something like that.
Oh.
But that's what they call it, the Gift.
Okay. Cool. Another thing, they managed to get 5,000 people onto the boats. As far as I know, maybe most of them were killed. I'm not sure.
I think they mentioned 5,000. Yeah,
they specifically do. Yeah.
Okay.
So, does 5,000 troops being added?
And they
to...
are all troops. It looks like that they were prioritizing.
Yeah,
children
okay.
and elderly people that couldn't move. I'm like, good.
Fair point.
And elbowing the healthy young men that are trying to get, like, get the fuck off here.
Yeah, it's a Titanic situation, right?
Yeah,
panic on the Titanic,
including people probably freezing to death in water.
Yep.
Maybe including a giant. We'll see if they're just towing a frozen body behind.
So maybe there aren't very many troops coming. I was going to ask if 5,000 troops added to Stannis' force changes a siege equation at all. It doesn't seem like it would because it's still a siege. It's still bad weather, but these guys are prepared to survive in cold weather.
The only thing I'd say, and this is just me speculating off the cuff of my pants, is that Roose haughtily said, can Stannis's horses jump walls?
Yeah.
Or how high can they jump? Well, these fucking wildlings can climb a 700-foot ice wall on
true.
The reg.
Yeah.
So you tell them to climb a 70-foot high Winterfell wall, and you tell 5,000 to do that. I wonder if we're supposed to
Or you
to
get
kind
one
of,
fucking giant.
Yeah. Yeah, just push down the wall.
Uh-huh. What are you going to do against that?
Nothing.
So, I don't know. We know that the giant makes it out of the fight. I don't know if he's going to swim to the wall or what, but he seemed to be cool with wading into that water. No
yeah,
problem.
Yeah, I feel like a giant can wade through ice-cold water and probably even dog yeah. paddle out and just climb up the side of a ship. No, but people are like, how are you going to get the... He's a fucking giant. He's a giant that lives in the land of always winter. He can deal with cold.
Yeah, I don't think he's going to fit in a boat, but I don't know that he needs to.
Well, I mean, those boats from Stannis are like no shit giant big ships, like Mayflower type.
Oh,
boats.
Are they? These are just like
ferry. You saw in the distance there was like just 50 okay. plus, maybe even 100 ships out in the harbor, and these are just a rowboats kind of like.
Gotcha.
Because you can't just you can't take a big ship on the beach.
They're shuttlecraft.
They are.
We're gonna continue with
maybe
the Star
even
Trek.
A roundabout. Class.
Yeah.
a little bit bigger than shuttlecraft.
Good. Those are comfortable. They have leather seats.
That's season 7 is all about the Defiant class rowboat.
I really don't
and
like
the blade of armor shields.
It is. Is the facial anomalies of the Thin comparable to Worf's facial anomalies?
I was thinking that the Lord of Bones, like the Lord was, of Bones. Was a good that he could be
okay.
If he lived, he could shout like rammings because that was Worf's first fucking instinct in Deep Space Nine.
Oh, yeah.
A console explodes and he's in control of the Defiant. Fucking ramming speed.
Captain Kirk is worried about getting his crew off the ship.
Worf's ramming speed. No, it's actually a small fire. We actually had ramming speed.
We got it. It's almost out.
Yeah. Really? We have full magazines of photon torpedoes. We could like maybe shoot them first, see how that goes. Ramming speed.
So I don't like this contrived fight stuff very much. I hate to see great choreography ruined by poor reasoning. So John's rummaging around for the dragon glass, right?
All right.
And he's got his back turned and the Thin's fighting the White Walker.
Sure.
White Walker kills the Thin, walks over to John, grabs him by the scruff of his neck and throws him.
Okay.
He has just impaled a man with that same spear. Why can't he impale John through the back with the spear?
Plot armor.
God damn it. I hate that stuff, man.
So here's the thing, though. I was annoyed by that, too, and I was watching the second one, and I was looking, and it seems like what was happening was the White Walker was missing on his killing stroke.
Like, every time with John?
And
yeah.
Then, like, he was in position to hit him with the butt of the staff, and that's, like, the thing, like, because the position of the choreography, he was now, his momentum had carried him past, so he was either backhanding him or he was hitting him with the blunt end of the staff.
I'm talking specifically when John is hunched over, back to him, rummaging around for dragon glass. Yeah, the White Walker comes up, grabs him with the non-spear hand and throws him.
Because I was looking for that, and I was a little mollified. I'm like, okay, this is actually better choreography than I suspected, which I was already amazed with.
Yeah, the rest of it is awesome.
Because that's the thing.
I don't have a problem with any of it.
Yeah, like I hate fights where there's obvious chances for killing blows and foes motivated to get the killing blow, and they just choose not to do it.
I understand if you want to deliver like a monologue there. And, like, that stops you from killing the person.
Yeah, all-out monologue, sure.
Yeah, but to, you know, to try to harm them without killing them is silly.
Okay. Now, do you think... we got a feedbacker. I'm not going to step on their toes. I've had to, by necessity, step on a lot of toes this week. I'm going to try to avoid that.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd. We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, well, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
The other thing I wanted to talk about... White Walkers and water. What's up with that? They refuse to go in this water. Can they just dig a moat in front of the wall and be cool?
I don't know.
Like, is that going to work?
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
I took this as... So I've been thinking about this in terms of, like, why haven't we seen the White Walkers? And it could be that they're just really smart. Like, why do we want to kill 100,000 wildlings when we can drive them through the wall, have them kill the defenders of the wall, mop up the dead, and then destroy the rest? Like, they seem to be really smart about the way they're almost herding these people and making the living fight each other, and then they just reap the rewards. And I wonder if this was like a psychological thing. Like, you got your 5,000 people in the boats, are mostly women and children and sick old men and not warriors. You know, the badass wilding woman being maybe all the women fight like that. Maybe all the children do too. Who the fuck knows? But I wonder if it's kind of like, we're going to deliberately let you escape to spread the terror of us.
Yeah.
To make our job easier. Like, we could utterly kill you right now, but what would that do strategically?
Okay.
Whereas if we let you, it's kind of like the classic, I'm going to spare you so you can, you know, the Inglorious Bastards. I'm going to let you go so you can then go and spread terror of us around the ranks. Because say what you will about the White Walkers, they do seem to be very smart.
I think so.
Like, I don't know if they're superhumanly intelligent, but they certainly have a command structure and they do things in very deliberate, intelligent fashion.
Yeah.
So that's the only thing.
At least the commanders, you know, the armies of the undead seem to be as dumb as armies of the undead would be, but
yeah.
They're led well.
I will say that when he was raising his hands, I was worried that the ice was going, and like, good fucking God, row the fucking boat, man. Row the boat. I was worried that you'd start to see ice spreading, that he was going to use some kind of magic ice power.
Because
I feel like they could. And it does also
feel... I feel like they could too.
It also feels like they certainly radiate cold. I think that explains why, as the guy was walking through the room, the like fires died out around them. So it could be that they... When the long nights come, the really especially brutal winters, it's when they themselves are actually coming into action. And maybe there's been dozens of these incursions over the years we don't even know about because they're stopped by some reason. Who knows? Maybe the children of the forest. Maybe the guy, the Saruman, the Dingy up on the tree is fighting a guerrilla war against these guys and they just can't do it no more, which is why they're reaching out. There's like so many different ideas about why. Because... I've gotten the impression that if the White Walkers win, that nothing on Planetos is safe, that you will essentially have an ice age. Like, Dorne will freeze, the summer sea will freeze over, everywhere will freeze over.
Even the other continent.
Yeah.
Even Essos. Huh?
Yeah, I think that, like, you'll have a ball of ice for a world if they win. That's my, I don't have anything to base that on other than what we've seen on the show. But that's always been my gut feeling that's the stakes.
Yeah.
If you lose the war to the White Walkers, you then have a snowball planet.
Okay. All right. Yeah. I don't know. It's interesting because I'm not sure what necessarily the consequences would be for other continents. It doesn't seem like, I don't know why they're contained. I mean, yeah, if the Tree Master or whatever is fighting them, maybe he's kept them contained for a while, but
I will say
I don't
that
know what would contain them then.
It does seem that the wall does a hell of a job of containing them. And maybe they can't cross salt water. Maybe it's like, you know, some lore that we haven't discovered yet, like vampires. Vampires in mythology can't cross running water.
Yeah.
And you see that with the Strain and shit, like they pay homage to that. But I don't know. I mean, nobody really does. Mm. There's still a lot to learn about them. And that's the one thing that I've always... I've talked about this in the spoiler cast, and now I can talk about it on the show. I very strongly disagree that if any theory that just postulates the White Walkers are a fundamentally evil force, because that doesn't, that's very Lord of the Rings. And the one thing George has always said and been critical of the Lord of the Rings, because it's like the great granddaddy of all this shit, is that it's very black and white. There's no gray.
Yeah.
It's like Aragorn versus the Witch King. Mm-hmm. Who do you root for? Gee whiz. The guy that runs around with the elves, the flowers in his hair, the guy who's got a fucking steel crown and, you know, death and devastation.
Yeah.
It would be very shocking and disappointing to me if the White Walkers are just some monolithically evil race that just is hell-bent on destruction. They have to have a rational motivation. There's theories that maybe that somehow the men have provoked the White Walkers. In some like ancient pack, because this is all stuff that happened thousands of years ago. There's a theory that says that maybe the wall was created by White Walkers to keep men out. And the fact that the wildlings have been flourishing north of the wall, like despite all their efforts, is like pissed them off.
What if they've seen the gathering of the wildlings as a threat?
Well, sure.
Like thinking they're going to attack them.
It's an aggression, act of aggression. It could be that like 8,000 years ago when they had the original war, one of the peace terms is... We can't really produce normally. We had a deal with the Children of the Forest that are first men to like give us whatever, like maybe the lame or what. You have to give us a
or
certain
Craster?
Amount of.
Like, I wonder if Craster was keeping
see,
them.
See, Craster always said, I hold to the old gods. Yeah. What if men are like massively reneged on the agreement to give them offspring and they're pissed and now they're coming to claim what's there? Like, if it's just I'm an evil, incomprehensible alien race that cannot be reasoned with, it'll be very un-Martin-like. So,
yeah.
There's got to be something there.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, that, you know, John's able to kill one of them.
Sure.
And I think that raises an eyebrow for the rest of them, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay, we're not just going to run over these fools as much as we thought we were. But I don't know that that puts much of a dent in them, honestly. Like, killing one of their guys, big deal.
Yeah.
It's just another angle, another thing that they didn't think could happen.
Yeah, because that's the other thing. It's like, this happened so long ago. Do they remember their weaknesses? Like, the last time?
Sure.
Like, is this guy with the crown, is he literally 8,000-plus years old and he remembers the first battle with men? Or do they have, like, humanish lifespans? Like, maybe long, but nobody knows. Yeah. Nobody really knows. It's all speculation.
Yeah. Interesting.
But, again, you know, these are intelligent beings with a culture of their own. We even talked about when it was creepy when they turned to infant, but it didn't feel especially evil. Like,
yeah,
the guy carrying the infant was taking, like, care of it, and you know, it wasn't like a it was more of just like, this is... You know,
which could be, I mean, it could be foreshadowing of, you know, Craster being important to that whole equation.
Yeah.
That could be
like, he had one,
you know,
guy.
They're taking care of someone who they know they're going to turn into one of their own.
Sure.
They want to.
And they never fucked with Craster.
Yeah.
So that could be a big clue. Like, there's this one guy who is still keeping the faith, and that was enough to keep us. But now you fucked him over and we're coming for you.
Yeah. And I mean, it ties into the theme of the greater good, too. I mean, what he was doing up there was certainly horrible, right?
Sure.
But is it the greater good? Is it the hard decision that needs to be made?
Yeah.
That's a question that I'm not prepared to answer here, but want to at least get people thinking about it.
The other thing is, like, you know, well, why would you choose to be a White Walker? Well, why would you choose to be a Night's Watch? Like, it's a shitty life that really limits your opportunities, but some men are drawn to it because of whatever. Like, maybe in the old days, it wasn't seen as, like, an especially bad thing to be chosen as another, a White Walker to be turned. Maybe it was even an honor, and we've forgotten that and built, you know, the wall. And
or, I mean, another thing, Craster could be just an evil son of a bitch too, right? Like, he could be giving all of the male,
that's the thing,
children to them to create a force that's capable of destroying the
that's
South.
What blurs the line, because unquestionably Craster was an evil son of a bitch.
Yes, by our standards, absolutely.
But did the White Walkers, are they did they make him that way? Or are they just,
know.
You know, like, he's just offering them tribute. Maybe they'd rather have full-grown men and women that come willingly, but it's like, we'll take babies because what else are we going to do? We don't know. We know nothing about these people, which is amazing that we're like 75% through the series and we know so little.
Yeah.
It'd be like not knowing the Lannisters. Lannister's just fucking over Starks, but we've never met him. We don't know any of the characters. We don't know what they want. We just know they're killing all of our dudes.
Sure.
And that's kind of like what the White Walkers are at this point.
I have one more question, and then I think we're done.
Possibly have an answer. I don't know.
How do you think this battle happened? Like, does the White Walker force know about the going-ons of the wildlings? Do they know that John is on his way up there? Are they planning this attack, or was this a coincidence?
I don't know. There's an email that gets to the heart of that. Let's save it for that.
Okay. Well, I think we're done with the episode recap.
I do, too. Actually, I forgot a couple things I want to talk about. The Darth Maul-looking White Walker. He looked to me like he had elf ears. Well, no, that's important because...
Okay, why is that important?
Well, like, if the baby didn't grow magic elf ears, like, people are always trying to figure out, are these all people? Were they all formerly people? Or are they distinct species? If they have, like, elf ears, then that would imply that they're not people. And also, I actually watched the last episode, The Children of the Forest, the leaf character that threw the fireballs. She had human-looking ears. So it's like, they're not even, like, corrupted or frozen Children of the Forest, I don't think. I just think, you know, since we know nothing about them, I just want to throw that as something that maybe people can run with.
The ears got cold. They broke off.
Well, that's the other thing is, like, I thought that those growths on his head were actually part of his skin. But when he kind of looks, there's one point he turns to the sun, and it looks like those horns are translucent, and also the tips of his ears did too. So it could just be those are like frost jewelry or something.
Body mods?
Well, I mean, I'm saying like, you know, he's wearing like a literal crown of thorns. So I don't know that his ears are elfish or they're just frozen.
Got his ears clipped. He got his tongue cut down the middle.
His like a face lizard. Buttholified. Yeah, uh-huh. Sure.
He's going to tattoo his entire face to look like a lizard next season. We have a sponsor this week, Aaron.
Great.
As you know, we've been talking about Harry's for a while now. They're the Shave Club. Where you can go online, you can order all your shave products from them, and they'll ship them to you each month, depending on how often you shave. So, you know, you shave a couple times a week, they'll ship you a few blades a month. You don't need all that many. It's pretty cheap that way. Mm-hmm. So you just get what you need, you pay for what you need. You don't have any extras that you can't use.
What if you have a Valyrian steel beard such as mine? How often?
Ooh.
How many blades did you go through?
I mean, I would use, like, if you're going to shave, I would use one blade to take it all off. Throw that blade in the trash because it's useless now.
Yeah.
And then start with a fresh blade.
Okay.
Then you'll be good.
All right.
I think. But as you know, Father's Day is coming up in a couple of weeks.
I do.
And Harry's has you covered for Father's Day. They've got the Father's Day set. We also have you covered because if you go to harrys.com and you want to get your father something nice, get him a shave kit, which you know he can use. Every man can use a shave kit.
Sure. It's a nice one, too. I looked at it online.
It is. It comes in really nice packaging. It has a nice stand and everything. Keeps your blades fresh, out of the water, and in good working condition. You go there, you use the code GOT when you check out, and you get $5 off that package.
Nice.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a good way to help out Bald Move, help out Harry's, because Harry's is started by a couple of guys just like us, honestly. Just a couple of guys who are passionate about shaving.
Hard working, more business savvy.
Oh, well, certainly, yeah. Better marketing, at just about everything. But
delivery, yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, to say they're just like us is probably a slight against them. But
in fact, I just heard, what's that? Oh, they pulled our ads.
Oh, God.
Back it up.
But yeah, I mean, if you're looking for a good Father's Day gift, and who isn't in the next couple of weeks?
I'm desperate for one. You know how hard it is to shop for my old man?
I don't know.
It's impossible.
All right. All you can buy him is motorcycles?
Yeah, I mean... Okay. Sorry, I drove us to a dead end here.
You did. Hopefully he doesn't with his motorcycles. So, yeah.
Dark!
Go check them out. I've been using their products for like 6 months now. Really enjoying them. They're real good. I switched over from another shave club, which won't be mentioned. The bad one, yeah. To the good one, Harry's. So go check them out, harrys.com.
It's funny that a company called Harry's is the good shave company.
Right? Yeah, it's
they need me
fairly
for the
ironic
spokesman.
Name.
They need me for the spokesman.
You could be the Jared of Harry's.
There you go.
I lost my beard, my whole beard, when I switched to Harry's.
I lost 35 pounds of beard weight just by switching to Harry's.
Awesome. Yeah, go check it out, harrys.com. Use the code GOT. Get $5 off your first order.
Sounds great.
All right, let's get some feedback.
All right, moving on to Jesse M. In this episode, we learned that Valyrian steel is able to kill White Walkers, which isn't surprising because it's forged in dragon fire. That's speculation, not fact.
Okay.
This made me think of where else we know Valyrian steel exists, and that's Brienne's sword, Oathkeeper. She's also up in the north, so maybe we can expect some Brienne White Walker fight scenes later on. Thought that last episode was so intense, I'm not sure we'll see another White Walker battle scene as large as that by the end of the season. What is your opinion about Brienne and Oathkeeper making his way to the wall?
Well, if Sansa gets free and she wants to go see her brother, maybe.
Okay.
I don't know how else it would happen.
All right.
I don't know what reason she would have to go north. There's another sword hanging around, Joffrey's sword, right?
Yeah, Widow's Wail.
I don't,
or Heart Eater or Heartsbane.
I don't know where that went after he died.
I would suspect Tommen has it, because a Valyrian sword's not something you bury.
It's a family
heirloom that is passed down through generations.
Okay.
And the Lannisters are salty because they lost theirs like 100 years ago. moving on to Mike McSee, is Valyrian steel made of dragon glass? When Jon Snow struck the White Walker, it was destroyed in the same manner as when Sam stabbed the White Walker a few seasons ago. What's your opinion, Jim?
Made of dragon glass, or like partially?
Well, you know, like
I guess it could be infused with
essentially
dragon
steel
glass.
Is iron that's been mixed with coal.
Oh, okay.
Like you put carbon, that's like a, they think that steel was invented by accident, that they were working, the blacksmiths were working steel, and they're like, hey, this metal seems a lot harder than the others, but it's more brittle. And they then start playing with adding carbon to it. So is it possible that this is steel infused with obsidian?
Yeah, sure.
That's certain. I mean, no one, I can't stress this enough, no one fucking knows. Like, making a Valyrian steel is a lost art. There's only a handful of people that know how to reforge existing stocks of metal. So nobody really knows. Why don't the White Walkers use their quote-unquote death wind in multiple waves of attack instead of just the initial strike? I know it wouldn't be as dramatic, but the death wind appears to be more efficient.
I think death wind stopped by walls, by the gates, I think.
I have a question for you. Why doesn't a boxer just throw haymakers for 12 rounds?
He'll get winded.
Yeah, I feel like that, you know, it's like, yeah, World of Warcraft and magic cooldowns feel artificial, but like, I can't do an infinite amount of push-ups. I can't throw an infinite amount of pushes or punches.
Yeah, I don't know. When you throw magic in the equation, it gets a little harder to say they have physical limitations.
But to the extent that you ground it in reality, nothing is infinite. And I think Game of Thrones feels like there is always cost to things. You can't just get shit for free.
Okay.
So that's my response. I don't know, because no one really knows the rules. But if something is really badass, they can't just spam it, for lack of a better word, because they just wear themselves out. Mm-hmm. Ephraim MR says, although it's clear last season when we see the Night King turn the baby into a White Walker, it's now even more evident that these are sentient thinking beings, organized and trained in battle with a military structure. And hell, piecing together all I've seen so far, I might say there's even a culture to them. Is this White Walker culture explained in the books? Is there something you could share with us without spoiling the books too much? Nope, because I don't know. Don't know. Like, I've, as much as I shared in just last, is all just shit that book readers have kind of made up to kind of try to explain events we've seen in the books, and also that's been transcribed in the show.
Yeah, from what I can understand, your book White Walker is more of an enigma than the show White Walker.
Oh, we've seen way more show White Walker.
Yeah.
Like the
that
fact,
baby stuff never happened.
The fact that Valyrian steel can kill him, didn't know. Yeah. The fact that they transform human babies into that stuff that book readers hinted, you know, because, you know, Craster was doing, he was said he was offering them. We didn't know. Now we know because of the television show. So, yeah, show watchers, arguably a person only watching a show knows more about the White Walkers than a person that only read the books. And also, I think that I remember in interviews with the Double D's saying, when we first saw the White Walkers, you recall that they made like this elaborate symbols with the heads of the men and horses they killed.
Yeah.
And they said that was deliberately to show people that they did have a culture and an intelligence, that they weren't just like your average, you know, zombie. Mm-hmm. So this is just now like we're seeing all these chickens come home to roost, and we're getting it's obvious now. Naaman says, is there anything dragon related, or is it that anything dragon related is the only thing that can destroy White Walkers? Will Bran warg into dragons and lead the other two, or into Drago rather, and lead the other two dragons to save the North?
I mean, it kind of makes a certain elemental sense, right?
Right.
Dragons and fire.
Ice and fire.
Yeah.
Also, this, you know, the theory that I had of like, we're not going to see new types of magic. We're going to see combinations of magic. We have dragons, we have dragon glass and Valyrian steel that have some ties to the dragon culture being proof against White Walkers.
Yeah, we think.
You take the peanut butter and the chocolate together and you get a great taste, which is Bran potentially warging into dragons.
All right.
Like,
sounds cool.
Like the Saruman the Dingy said, that you're never going to walk, but you can fly. You know, is he just talking about crows?
I hope he wargs into the one that Tyrion's riding, is all I can say.
Oh, Tyrion's going to ride dragons now?
Yeah. Well, that's been my theory for a while.
Oh, really?
A good long while, yeah.
We should talk about this, because that's...
I've said it's just going to be like the never-ending story. He's going to be riding Falgor into King's Landing.
Sure, when 80 synth track is throbbing behind.
Oh, yeah,
like,
totally.
As the theme of
he's going to have the headband.
As our podcast theme plays in the background.
His hair is going to get a little bit longer. See, he's going to be a Atreyu by the end of this.
I can't do it. All right, Sean M. says, crazy thought on the book releases. I know there's no precedent for this as it takes GRRM, GERM, so long to write a new book, but what if he has been effing with us? What if he's working on both books right now? It'd be amazing if we were to get the final two books at the beginning of 2016 and 2017 prior to each new season on HBO. Hmm. It feels as if the Double D's are not trending too much into new things this season, knowing that at least The Winds of Winter will be available in time for season six. Maybe Dream of Spring could follow it up. Martin should know how he wants to end the story. Hopefully the bullet points are there, and now it's just a matter of telling the story. Do you buy that he is secretly working on both books and he's going to drop them a year apart from each other?
What other explanation could there be?
That he's a slow writer.
Oh my God. I don't want to believe that. I don't want to believe that. I don't know, man. It's
here's
like, I'm not super invested in this because I don't read the books.
And you never will.
But I'm, it's a curiosity to me.
Yeah, no,
but the man has had what, 15 years?
He's been working on this for 20. Game of Thrones has been on the air for, like, in development for 6, maybe 7 years. And Dance of Dragons came out 5 years ago.
That they picked up this show, you should start shitting your pants.
Yeah.
And say, I need to write these books.
Yeah.
Instead, he's writing Duncan Egg Chronicles and
working on anthologies.
The World of
Women
Westeros. Yeah. I don't know what's going through that guy's head, frankly.
I don't either.
He's a complete mystery to me.
I wonder, because famously he struggled on books 4 and 5 with the Meereenese Knot, which is,
okay,
you got Danny over here in Meereen with, for good reasons, because he's a gardener, not architect. You got everybody else interesting over at Westeros. How the fuck do you get these plots together? And it took him 2 books and 2 different timelines and a bunch of bullshit to figure that out. And
yeah,
maybe once he got that resolved, he thought it would be smooth sailing. And then he got the Winds of Winter and he's like, ah, oh, how do I get, I got
the Northern Knot.
I got a Winterfell Knot now. Uh-huh. What the fuck is going on? I don't know. Sean, I would say that I find it unlikely because, like, you see that shit in the Hollywood, right? You know, the first movie of a trilogy went well. We're going to film the other 2 trilogies as part of a whole.
Yeah.
And then release them because why? It saves money. It saves money to get all that filming done. Books don't work that way.
No.
Like, every year that he does not publish these books, he's turning away millions of dollars, and so is his publisher, of revenue, and they're not saving any. So I find it unlikely. Now, could he be doing this just as a way to, like, troll the fans? Like, hey, I'll drop Winds of Winter next spring, and I'll drop Dream of Spring next spring? Maybe.
Yeah.
But it'd certainly be, like you said, it's unprecedented, so... I think it's
we'll
probably
see.
Wishful thinking at this point.
Yeah, yeah.
I fully expect to maybe, I'm 50-50 whether we'll get Winds of Winter before next spring, and then I'm 1% chance that we'll get Winds of Winter before season 7 of Game of Thrones.
Wow.
Which has interesting interesting implications for the spoiler section.
Yeah,
big implications.
What do you do if there's no new book?
Probably don't do one.
Yeah.
You know,
how could you?
It's you know, we'll do it just like any other show, I suppose. Like, we'll talk about maybe leaks and other episodes and stuff, but, like,
you'll have to flip it on its head. It'll have to be a book spoiler podcast where you're talking about the show.
Yeah, which is essentially a 30-second section of me saying you should watch the show.
Yeah, yeah.
You should watch the show, son of a bitch.
It's all there.
Lily S. said, one thing I've been thinking about since Marjorie's imprisonment by the Faith is how the show has shown no reaction from the common people. However, we hear some jeers from the crowd towards Tommen as he walks up, towards the Sept about being an abomination, etc. It seems that in previous seasons, they made a point of showing to Margaery doing acts of charity and winning public support with her, even telling Joffrey how to win the love of the people.
Yeah.
You'd think that would help, being that the High Sparrow is supposed to be representing the common man, but so far the commoners are not appearing to be trying to help her. I'd be like, thanks a lot, assholes. That's the last time I give y'all free food and toy soldiers. I doubt this, but what if it's some symbolic message that Double D's are saying to the fans about how fickle the worship of the public is like? We give you 4 solid and fucking mind-blowing seasons, and 1 season takes some time to build up again, and you bitch about seeing dragons already? Come on, man! What do you think of that? Is any of this subtle commentary? Do you think that we haven't seen the common man's reaction? Do you think that actually will be a huge plot point before everything's said and done?
So if it's commentary, it's preemptive commentary, right? Like,
they'd have to know.
All right, we made 5 episodes. We know people are gonna fucking hate
this.
Yeah. We're this wheel is moving very slowly.
Yeah.
Let's build in an episode here. So I kind of discount any of that, given the nature of the filming of the show. Mm-hmm. But I think that's a fair criticism that we haven't seen much of the commoner's perspective. And it's interesting that Tyrion in this episode brings up the commoner to Dany. Mm-hmm. She thinks she's going to ride in and save the day, and the commoner is going to support her. But what really do they think? I feel like we don't know, and Dany certainly doesn't know.
Yeah.
I almost think that's there on purpose.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of like furthering my whole break the wheel, do something different besides top-down leadership, because the High Sparrow claims to be for the common man, but we know the common man loves Marjorie, like, from past seasons. So if they're getting accurately represented, then Marjorie should get off easy and Cersei should get the book thrown at her.
I would hope so, yeah.
The Pillars of the Seven Stars, or Seven-Pointed Star, or whatever the book is called. So yeah, I think it's more, I don't know. I don't know whether we'll see like a popular revolt against the High Septon or the High Sparrow.
Yeah, I wonder.
He's overstepping his bounds. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It's all fun and games when you got Cersei in prison, but Marjorie, that's serious business. Paul M. says, who do you think makes the White Walkers cool uniforms? I only read this because...
The same company that makes Captain America's uniform.
Some people have looked at the show and has seen commonalities between the Night's Watch uniform designs and the White Walker uniform designs.
Hmm. Okay.
That essentially the White Walker uniforms are arguably more ornate, elegant versions of what the Night's Watch is wearing. And if you imagine the Night's Watch thousands of years ago when they're fully garrisoning 13 castles and had tons of money and honor and prestige, and maybe they would actually wear uniforms that looked more like the black, cool-looking armor that the Knights want. Now they're just wearing, like, leather jerkins and bullshit like that.
Yeah.
And people are wondering if that's hinting that there is some kind of common shared history, that maybe the Knights Watch is a perversion of what it used to be, or that they have similar backgrounds. And that's show speculation. That has nothing to do with the books. That's just...
Sure.
Based on the visual motifs of the different armors and how close proximity they are geographically.
I like that in that it invites a lot of speculation.
Yeah. It's kind of similar to like Lord of the Rings. Like they did that intentionally. Like when they showed scenes of like the Second Age, the elves, they intentionally made their armor like shinier and cooler and more ornate. Hmm. And then when you see them like 1,000 years down the line, still pretty awesome by man standards, but it's like scaled down versions of that because they've diminished as a people.
Yeah.
It's kind of that same fantasy hieroglyphics Rosetta Stone. You're like, oh, well, they did it in this. Well, maybe they could do it here.
Okay, that's cool.
I think it's something to keep our eyes on.
I think so, yeah.
Slade says, imagine he wonders if the White Walkers can resurrect any dead body, whether it's been in the ground for any arbitrary amount of time.
I mean, those skeletons that were buried up in the snow were pretty dead.
If so, then the South is in for a whole lot of hurt. Imagine thousands of years worth of dead buried emerging from the ground. We're easily talking about a million dead army here.
Yeah.
No one knows. I would suggest that maybe that the magic only works on a freshly dead corpse. And then that these guys popping out of the ground up north of the wall were like things enchanted from long, 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 long ago.
Sure.
And they'd just been laying dormant. Because otherwise, you're right. Westeros is fucked.
Yeah,
you walk
yeah.
through a dra- you just recruit by walking through dread you by through graveyards and raising your hands.
Yeah. So yeah, that's bad news.
Josh H said, you and Jim mentioned it very briefly during the instant cast, but do you think Danny's dragons will do against the whites and others? Not being the biggest Danny fan, but even if I was, I would think that it would be lame if a strafing run by dragons could destroy an entire white army. When the White Walker walked into the burning building, the fire seemed to die a bit. Could the White Walkers be fireproof? I'm okay with the good guys winning, but I don't want Danny doing nothing until two scenes before the end and then flying up and destroying the army of the dead, as John calls them. You have to assume the White Walkers have been around a long time, would have another trick up their sleeve besides just their necromancy powers. As the Hardhome scene was totally a show creation, I'm curious what you two think of the seemingly inevitable Walker-Dragon showdown. What do you think, Jim?
First of all, I agree that it's seemingly inevitable. I think even the name of the series,
Song of Ice and Fire,
would indicate that. I'm kind of with you that I don't know that a dragon's fire alone is going to be enough to stop the White Walkers. I think it probably burn the shit out of the whites, though. We've seen them go up in flames.
They seem to be made of kerosene and kindling.
Yeah.
That's like their magical weakness is fire.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you can get John swinging the Valyrian swords, get a couple of brothers with dragon glass and a couple of dragons from above, mm-hmm. I think you probably do some damage to these guys.
But they are showing the fire suppression powers, for lack of a better word, of the White Walkers for a reason. Like, it's not...
Yeah, that's what I mean.
I'd be very surprised that it's just going to be a straight up one for one, no countermeasure. You're just fucked. You forgot about dragons, bitch.
Yeah.
You thought they were dead. Surprise, there's three of them.
It seems to me that the Valyrians needed more than their dragons, right? Why else create this Valyrian steel that's capable of killing a White Walker? I'm saying dragons deal with the whites.
Yeah.
Humans with Valyrian steel and Dragonglass deal with the White Walkers.
Yeah, and who knows how many White Walkers there are? What if there's a million of them?
Sure,
they're just up there chilling, you know. So it could be like, yeah, the dragons can even the odds a bit, but you still have to have, you know, men and women of stout hearts against the men and women of ice hearts or something. I don't know.
That's what it feels like to me, but I don't know.
All right, Robert S. I couldn't help but think this episode highlighted something I feel is often overlooked. Dany's not only unlikable, she's a terrible leader. You have Jon Snow acting courageously and wisely for the 1,000th time while Dany sits and whines and does nothing. I think this highlights that Jon should be the leader of the people that the people can get behind and not Dany. I know some people like Dany, but I'm not one of them. I'm Team Jon all the way. How do you read the situation?
You bring up a good point about Dany's inactivity.
Mm-hmm.
Why is she sitting on her duff at this point?
Because every time she leaves the city, they fall back into slavery and bullshit, so... She's decided this is where
But she's not at Slaver's Bay. Slaver's Bay is Marine?
Yeah, Marine's like the capital city of Slaver's Bay.
Well, she's not at the other cities in Slaver's Bay. I would assume that...
But that's what... That's
those
what,
cities are falling back into slavery?
Well, they were, but that's what Dario and Hisdar were out sorting earlier in the season.
Okay, so that's sorted.
They reconquered it. Well, at least one of the cities is. I'm not sure if all of them are.
Okay. I don't even remember the names of those cities, but...
Yunkai and Astapor.
Ah, yeah, okay.
I actually pulled Astapor out of my ass. I was really worried, like, oh, shit, I'm not going to know the third one.
Putting me on the spot. I don't know that I... She seems very concerned with this wheel, and yet she's not doing anything at the moment. And I don't know that she's a bad leader. I mean, Tyrion comes in, he says, okay, here's a couple of things that you did right.
Right.
I agree with those two things that you did most recently. And it wasn't until recently that she started leading with her heart again, I guess.
Yeah.
And her head.
Yeah.
Tyrion validated those things. So I don't know that she's a terrible leader. I think that she is inexperienced and she's in need of someone who can advise her properly.
Right. Well, so John, he grew up under Ned Stark, who was a terrible political leader down south.
Yeah.
But he inspired all kinds of loyalty amongst his men. And then Jon went to the Wall, where essentially is the hardest of hardcore northern senses of loyalty and honor. I mean, yeah, you got their horses and the horse thieves and rapists and murderers and all that up there.
Mm-hmm.
But the command structure is set around kind of those northern ideals. Whereas Dany was a baby and a child who was brought up by her abusive older brother and never given any kind of training, her example of leadership was her fucking brother Viserys, who was good it felt when he finally got his golden crown.
Oh, yeah.
So you think of her advisors have not been nearly on the level of at Winterfell, there was a maester on staff and he was able to educate all the children and you had... You know, Ned kind of trying to teach him concept of honor and Benjen. What was Dany's example? So is it surprising that she's perhaps not as effective a leader? When she has actually led like a war party, she's been really effective. Like she's inspired all kinds of loyalty. And she's having trouble governing. Put Jon Snow in Marine and see what happens.
Yeah, I don't know what would happen there.
Is he going to be able to effectively lead a team of like 100 black brothers? Like he, you know, there was already grumbling and all that, and they're all on the same side. Like,
but that just brings me back to like, I don't know if her goals are misaligned with her talents or something. Like,
that's possible.
I know she wants to defend the freedom that she has set up in these cities.
Yeah.
But, and that's one of her goals, but her main goal, it seems to be, is to take the throne and do something good with it.
It seems like her, maybe
she's not
her,
making any movement toward that.
Her talents are fire and blood, but what she's being called to do is diplomacy and very tricky governance of very different people that want different things. And again, like, you got to ask yourself, what would Jon Snow do in Meereen? Mm-hmm. He could be dead already. Who knows? But
I think Tyrion is much better suited to that.
I'm
frankly,
yes. You know, again, in the books, Tyrion was heading that direction, but he never made it into Dany's audience. So now that he's there, it's like super exciting. The possibility of him, you know, advising a worthy ruler is exciting. Clarence M. on Arya says, when is she going to come into contact with Meryn Trant? If you recall, that's the Kingsguard who was sent to guard Mace Tyrell, who was ordered by Cersei to go negotiate with the Iron Bank of Braavos.
Yeah.
At what point were her paths crossed with him? The entire purpose of Arya's storyline this season would be kind of dulled if we don't see her cross a name off her list. This is the longest we've ever seen her go without dropping a name. It seems pretty done deal that they will cross paths. I don't know if it's this season or next season. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, if they're going to be in the same city at the same time.
Yeah.
I can't imagine the show not going there.
What do you think the impact of that would be?
She might swoop in, because I firmly believe that Trant is going to try to kill Tyrell. Mm-hmm. Well, what's his name? Mace.
Mace.
She might be able to save him.
Hmm.
Mace Tyrell might know who she is.
What do you think the Faceless Men think of that?
That's a good question. I don't know that
I'm Lana, and she goes and acts as Arya.
Yeah, they probably won't like that, especially if she pulls Needle out to get the job done. Oof. Like, I'm not sure if she's going to be part of the Faceless Men if she does that. I could totally see Arya getting kicked out of the Faceless Men group.
Yeah.
Like, taking matters into her own hands at some point, like, and just getting kicked out.
Is Arya just becoming a faceless man? Is that an interesting endgame for her? Or, like, we've seen her Ciro Forel. That wasn't the endgame. That was just a point along the road. Even Jaqen in season 2, the Hound in seasons 3 and 4. Like, she all took something from them, but that wasn't the destination. So how likely is it that
Arya... I really think this is another step in her journey to learn to kill.
Where do you go from the Faceless Men?
Back to your list, I guess.
Yeah, so you
start killing. She's going to have a tough time with the
mountain.
You go
rogue? You go rogue?
Yeah.
Huh. All right. Dario, as leader of the... He does an analysis of all the potential leaders of the Sons of Harpy. Dario, as leader of Sons of Harpy, here's the points for. He did grow up in the fighting pits and says he owes everything he is to them.
Okay.
He knew how to fight or find the hiding Sons of Harpy. He knows he keeps trying to get Dany to kill all the masters, similar to Zaro Zon Duck Sauce from season 2. He mentions Dany should marry him instead of Hisdar. All of a sudden, he's pointing figure at Hisdar being the leader, possibly a classic Game of Thrones red herring. Evidence for Hisdar as leader.
Wait. Well, we're not getting any evidence against?
No. Would you care to give any? He loves Dany. He's boning her.
No. That's not evidence against. That's just a tactical play. He killed one of the Sons of the Harpy. So he'd have to be killing his own guys, which, you know,
classic,
you could see the long con.
Villain move, sure.
Yeah, it's a long con. But I think that's a fairly substantial point against it.
Okay. Hisdar is leader of the Sons of Harpy. In the second episode, he did act suspiciously ignorant to knowing who the Sons of Harpy were, and he is, quote, part of a prominent family, and he never heard of them. If he were an advisor in Westeros, he would have been sniffed out in seconds. The Sons of Harpy stopped killing once he was named as the future king.
Mm-hmm.
He had to know the Fighting Pits people are still slaves, and he's the head of the most prominent house in all of Meereen.
Yeah, I think the finger is pointing firmly at him at the moment.
A supporting of a dual axis power of Hisdar and Dario being co-leaders of the Sons of Harpy.
Oh my god, okay.
Dario did say that a prominent family bought his freedom from the fighting pits. Him and Hisdar have traveled together to quell the rebellions of Yunkai. What if Dario knows Hisdar and his family because they were the family that bought his freedom? Is there a conspiracy, Jim?
I forget. So I remember, you know, basically how Dario and Danny hooked up, she came in, she was trying to free these people, and they were a force that was paid to protect the city. Mm-hmm. She convinced them, convinced specifically Dario to kill the other guy mm-hmm. and join her instead. Are we to believe that that was a long con? Because you would have to go back that far. I think.
I don't know. That seems pretty unlikely.
I think so too. Yeah.
But on the other hand, there is a little, I mean, there's, it feels like it fits the shape of things. Like there's key words like a rich family freed me. This guy's the head of the richest, most prominent family. Like there are some, it kind of fits together, but you're right. Like you're assuming that this conspiracy goes back a long, long ways.
And that Hisdar, in an effort to get Dario into the good graces of Danny, would be willing to give up a whole city.
I don't know.
I mean, maybe he doesn't have any stake in that city, but it seems like a long shot to me that Dario's involved.
If their end game is to get slavery back in Marine, they've already won.
Seems like it.
So it could be that, I mean, it could be a purely financial motive. Scott V says, that Battle of the White Walkers is awesome, but I have a question. The White Walkers only showed up because they can sense the dragonglass, right?
They can sense dragonglass.
Is that
White Walker?
You touched on this.
Sense
in the
Valyrian steel. I know that much, but
well, that could be a surprise. Could very well be the first time they've experienced Valyrian steel. Like if the last
really,
I don't know. I'm just saying that the last time I know that humans and White Walkers thrown down was like 8,000 years ago.
Sure, I mean that's an answer to the question I had. Yeah, like how did they know? Is this an ambush? Is this a coincidence?
Maybe the Azor Ahai guy originally was the first guy to discover dragonglass, and it was kind of a shock. I don't know. Anyway, that was a speculation. He goes, if so, will any wildlings blame John for bringing the White Walkers down on them?
Well, he doesn't have the dragon glass anymore. The ones who got away might be pissed that all their families died. All
right, you brought the dragon glass. It's like a dog whistle to these guys.
How would they know that, though?
It's like some kind of mystical, like they can feel the vibration, like Spidey sense.
No. I mean the wildlings. How would they know that dragonglass is the thing that brought them?
Well, I mean, they just
jump to the conclusion.
It could also be that they're superstitious folk and that they might leap to, you brought dragonglass, the arch weapon of these guys, and then they show up literally within hours. I could see a superstitious people, even if there is no connection.
Maybe so.
Making that casual connection.
Yeah, but then again, it's a bunch of women and children and old men, so do you really care?
Yeah. Well, I mean, not all the
They're not going to help you out with the battle.
Yeah. He also was the guy to ask the question about Winter last podcast, and he wants to know, is there anywhere that Winter doesn't go in Westeros? If everyone falls back south far enough, are they safe? Can walkers get as far as King's Landing, for example? Nobody knows, but there is a little bit of a hint in the show that the White Walkers are literally bringing cold weather with them.
Yeah.
So it seems I would buy that, like if an army of White Walkers marched on King's Landing, it would bring frigid temperatures with them.
Yeah. I like how wrapped up that is in kind of ancient understanding of the world as well. Like winter kind of represents death.
Sure.
In a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's a hokey thematic thing to do in a piece of literature.
When you're a naked ape, frozen wastelands are a scary thing.
Yeah, but to give it personification,
I think, is
the more interesting part of that.
Sure.
Just like, you know, people point up at the sun and they say, oh, look, Ra's up
there.
That's
a good thing. That makes our plants grow.
Exactly.
Makes my skin warm.
Yeah.
This thing makes me hurt.
Yeah.
It kills me.
And there have been all sorts of gods throughout the ages, and
sure.
I think that's a different way of looking at it, that it's a force, not necessarily a god.
Yeah. Yeah, sure. And that's the things like, where on earth are you safe from glaciers? If you're living 15,000 years ago,
they move really slow. I mean, pretty much anywhere, I think.
But like, there's been times in this planet that we've had an ice age where the glaciers come, like, you know, you wouldn't be safe in Indiana, at least not the northern half. So
yeah.
You know, if you got something like that coming on a more regular mystical basis, who can say where you're safe?
Mm-hmm.
Jordan from England says, I was thinking about what action Kevin Lannister could take when he returns to King Landing. With young Tommen locked up in his bedchambers with Sir Pounce, it will be left to Kevin as active hand to deal with the situation. Not much is known about Kevin. It will be hard to predict his next move. My prediction is that Kevin shares his brother's determination to further the family line. Currently, there is no heir to Lannister, with Jaime a member of the Kingsguard, Lancel being with the Faith, and Tyrion being, well, Tyrion. One thing we are made clear of is the lack of affection for Cersei. He believes that he will testify against Cersei, confirming the illegitimacy of Tommen as king. Tommen will be stripped of his crown, but in doing so will be left free to carry on the family name, Kevin's main objective. Is Kevin going to go down there and father himself some sons and start a new land? Is he up to no good? Is he up to furthering the Lannister legacy? One.
What claim does he have to the throne? We've talked about the claim being through the Baratheons, right?
Yeah.
And the only reason Tommen's got it is because Cersei had it as his wife, right? And
yeah.
And Tommen was ostensibly his son, but if that's found out to be false,
you're right.
Kevin doesn't have a claim.
Yeah, no.
Who has a claim? No one.
Stannis.
At that point.
If
well, okay, yes. Stannis is the only one, but
he's got.
Who knows if he'll ever get to King's Landing?
That's the thing. But if the
what do you do with an absentee king? How do you fill that void in King's Landing? Is my question, I guess.
I would stop fucking around in Winterfell and just ride south as hard and fast as you can, because if you've got the best claim to the throne,
so you send a raven up to Stannis and say, "Hey, you're the king, bro. Get here."
Yeah, I mean that's the whole thing about the where's power reside. Like, will the if the Lannisters are fucked, would the Tyrells abandon them? Like, Martell seemed like they would support Stannis.
I think this is why George Martin is not writing the next books.
It's complicated.
Yeah, it really is.
It's complicated. We should start some Game of Thrones fan fiction in the off season.
Perfect. I love
it. Do Martin's job for him.
Let's get it on the forums. Let's
subcontract
get a thread
that shit out. Oh God.
Where each
that would
person
be
writes a paragraph.
You're allowed to write one paragraph.
We should totally do that. I would love to see that.
Jesus. Then we could read chapters on that. That's what the spoiler edition
there
will be
you
next
go.
Year.
That's perfect.
Oh, God. Matthew B., I'm a veteran of Iraq and Afghanistan, not to get into too many details, but I've been in some pretty nasty fights during my time in combat. Sometimes when we go out and spend a couple of days in crazy fighting, then come back to our forward operating base, we'd go right into the chow hall to get some food, and we'd always be some higher-ranking asshole to tell us our uniforms are dirty and we didn't have the proper eye protection on. That's all I was thinking is awaiting Jon Snow and the Wildlings when they get back to Castle Black. Alistair Thorne is that asshole who would say, "Your uniform is dirty." Jon Snow needs to show everyone that nothing matters apart from the threat of the Walkers. I thought this is interesting. I feel like that's a fairly right analogy. I can see Alistair Thorne being like, "Oh, you got in some problems with the White Walkers and the Army of the Dead."
Yeah, I mean,
Alistair's never been north of the Wall.
Sure. I agree. Alistair's an asshole through and through. I mean, but Jon Snow outranks him, right? So, like, Jon Snow comes back.
But what?
You don't tell a general. If you're a lieutenant, you don't tell a general your uniform's dirty when he gets back.
You know who outranked everybody?
Who's that?
Jor Mormont. And he got stabbed by the Fookin legend, man.
It's true.
So,
it's true. Rank isn't necessarily a shield.
Anyway, Matt, thanks for your service.
Yeah.
He also says, we can reasonably assume that most of the White Walkers, or can we reasonably assume that most of the White Walkers are boys from Craster's wives? I think the badass spear-wielding ones are probably the offspring of Craster. Do you think
there
he's coming to play later with Gilly's son? Like, will we see a Walker protect his brother? Is Gilly the aunt of the other Walkers? I'll throw in another one. What if the Walkers are down here because they're just pissed that one got away?
There you go.
Like, this is some bullshit. We had one guy keeping faith with us, and nah, you're too good to give your son up.
Yeah, I think, you know, he's just bringing full circle what we were talking about earlier, our speculation. I like it.
Yeah, lots of show speculation going on. Alan C. says, now that we know the Valyrian steel can kill White Walkers, do you think there's something to be said about Ned's great Valyrian sword being named Ice? A few things come to my mind. There was more than the name Ice than just being from the cold north. It was always described as a huge sword. Maybe that makes it better for fighting White Walkers. It was passed down through generations of Starks, and does that mean the ancient Starks used to fight the White Walkers? Best of all, now that we're partially back in the north, Ice is now partially back in the north since Brienne is carrying it in the form of Oathkeeper. Any of those float your boat?
I didn't know it was named Ice, for one.
I think it's funny that Tywin was saying, oh, it's an practically absurdly huge weapon that no one could wield. What if it's like you need a big badass sword like that to defeat giant ice beings?
Yeah, maybe. Or Tywin's just not man enough for that sword.
Yep.
Ned Stark was.
The famously limp Lannister wrist.
Yep.
Erin S. says, how many times now has Cersei said something to the effect of, I will burn their cities to the ground?
A lot.
In regards to any threats regarding her children. She's getting a little bit Where Are My Dragons territory with it, honestly.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Wearing us out.
Walt!
My theory is that...
Walt!
My theory is that Cersei's going to confess... Wait, Jesus Christ. My theory is that Cersei is going to confess in order to extradite herself from her prison cell, and then she's going to burn King's Landing down with wildfire. Aside from her comments about burning cities, the title of the episode also reminds us that she is willing to kill her children. Remember the Battle of Blackwater Bay when she was close to poisoning Tommen when she was thought that all was lost?
Mm-hmm.
Rather than see them suffer, which Tommen might if he is outed as a bastard and not the true heir to the Thorn, I began formulating this theory shortly after this week's, or before this week's episode. When Qyburn looked at Cersei in that prison cell and said, the work continues, it confirmed my theory even more. We're led to believe he's referring to the mountain, but I think he's actually making wildfire with her, for her.
Yeah, I mean, they need to make a lot of wildfire, because they used it all, didn't they, in Blackwater? Yeah,
didn't the Pyromancer talk a mess about, for some reason, their rituals of making wildfire has greatly increased?
Oh,
in season two.
I don't remember that.
And that's like kind of goes in line with all the like, just, you know, because it's a kind of borderline mystical process of creating wildfire. So maybe he is working on an improved method.
Yeah. I mean, the mountain with handfuls of wildfire would be pretty awesome.
Maybe the mountain with wildfire coursing through his veins.
There you go.
He's like Bane style from Batman. This guy's a big vat of glowing green shit pumping into his veins. That sounds kind of stupid, but. Maybe for the comic book version.
Yep.
Mike from Texas says, this is thought came to me during this episode, and I don't know if it's been mentioned before. Has anybody proposed a theory that the fight for the Iron Throne is like our world fighting over politics, the economy, and religion, but the real threat is winter and the White Walkers, which is inevitable, which is analogous to an inevitable destruction of global warming that will come for us if we don't do something about it?
Hmm.
I would say that that analogy works entirely based on how your political leanings are. If you think that climate change is a problem, you are probably like, yeah, right on. I can see that. If you don't, you're probably composing an angry email saying, keep your politics out of my podcast.
Can I just shit on you for a second for making this political issue?
For me?
Global warming a political issue? Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Shit on me.
I mean, it is a political issue, but it is turned into a political issue. It is a scientific issue. It is a definite problem for our species, but it is made a political issue by people who don't want to acknowledge its existence.
Yeah. Gay rights is a human rights issue, but it's also a political one.
Sure. I agree. It is also political, but to say that it is just political would be
mistake. Polls show that it's very starkly drawn down political lines. A lot of stuff is like that.
Sure, but not
like,
among scientists.
Well,
among scientists, it is almost 100% consensus.
Sure.
You
could say the same thing
get.
About genetically modified crops, except for the opposite political thing anti-vaccine.
Sure.
So it's like I like saying a political issue because that keeps me from like condemning everyone. Because honestly, as a radical moderate, I think you all are fucking idiots.
I'm willing to condemn
everyone. You're all fucking idiots and should shut up and listen to the men in the white lab coats when they talk.
But they don't talk very loudly. They don't assert themselves well.
No,
that's the problem.
They're polite and they're in their labs and they're messing with the test tubes. That's my thoughts as a moderate, but who knows?
Get your head out of the books. Get it in the game.
Enver M says, I find the way that Miguel Sapochnik framed the scene between Ollie and Sam was quite telling. In the profile shots, Ollie's window is wide open, beaming with light, and Sam's is almost shut. I cut this part out because it's framing, but he said essentially that you ruined the suspense of the wilding woman being killed because you have this rule of if someone says I'm going to make it back, they're going to die.
Yeah.
So it's like pseudo spoiled because they held to that filming convention. So now he's taking that thought and applying it to this filming convention. Just want to lay that framework there.
Okay. And then says some horrible things about John coming back, but
yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
That's also true. We talked about that. Anyway, Ollie's window's wide open, beaming with light, and Sam's is almost shut. On the one hand, Ollie's got his whole life ahead of him and the tons of opportunities to rise up in the ranks, perhaps become Lord Commander one day. On the other hand, Sam's day at the wall are numbered. In the parting shots, Ollie was framed in a long shot and seems to be surrounded by darkness, whereas Sam, they use a medium shot, and behind him there's candlelight. There's light at the end of the tunnel for Sam, albeit dim. I'm not sure what they have in store for Ollie, but it looks like he is destined for the dark side. Their present situation versus future outlook are complete opposites, I believe, is what they're trying to portray here. Do you buy this visual analysis?
Yeah, you might be right. I don't know that all of the discussion with Ollie has been enough to convince him. John, Sam, I don't know that they're going to be able to convince him when his whole village was slaughtered by these people.
All right, moving on. Joseph K., what are your thoughts on how quickly it seems that Danny has begun to trust Tyrion? After all, she has his word for the deeds he claims to have committed. If she believes the Lannisters to be as cunning and evil as she has indicated, how can she be swayed into seemingly trusting this man's counsel after a mere hours? Or to trust him at all, actually. The viewers, of course, know the real truth, but it seems to me that it does not play out in a convincing fashion in the show. I still love them getting together, even if I feel it is weak. I did not have this problem, but I can't articulate why.
She makes the point. She makes that exact point. She says, you want to be my counsel because you killed your family.
Yeah.
What closer people could there be than your family? I'm going to take you under my wing. What are you going to do to me? That's a dangerous thing. She makes that point in the episode.
But she's also, I agree with that.
That's a dangerous thing.
And she was alone with him. I mean, I'm sure there's guards right outside. There might even been in the room with her, but she's drinking wine.
She was,
That Tyrion is pouring. Mm-hmm. Like, now that I think about it, it is odd. But I guess they lulled me to sleep because I had this mind that she kind of put, you know, that somehow this question of what to do with Jorah was kind of an addition. And she went with her gut, what her gut told her based on that. And yeah, that
You're right, problematic
now that I'm thinking about it. But I, you know, that's a problem with television shows. Like, you know, there's some things that don't work on first contact. There's some things that don't work because of a person's personal, like, level of engagement with the show. And there's some things that don't work because it's horse shit.
Sure.
And that's, like, the thing about being a critic is you try to figure out what are my own personal biases, what are my own personal weaknesses, and what are kind of universal truths.
So we know that Danny has made bad decisions in the past.
Plenty of them.
We as an audience know that Tyrion is trustworthy, and then all he says is true.
Yes. And he's a good person.
Generally speaking. Yeah. So I feel like as an audience member, you're able to gloss over the idea that this is really for a leader who does not, who has no reason to trust this person is a terrible decision.
Yeah.
But we know she's made terrible decisions and we know that he's telling the truth. So we're okay with it, I think.
Yeah. I will say that I think the more I think about it, yes, having three slow episodes built up tension, but in retrospect, it seems like maybe they could have gotten to some of this stuff a little bit earlier or accelerated it some in the beginning so that we had a full episode of her maybe trying to figure out whether she can trust him or not, or maybe even lampshade it by saying, I just received a raven from a contact, but she doesn't have any contacts in Westeros that we know.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think of how Barriss? She would research.
She'd trust him.
Like if Barristan was still alive.
Yeah.
That would have helped out a lot. And now that she's turned Jorah out to exile, I'm trying to figure out why they killed Barristan.
I don't know.
Because he would have been perfect for that role to, like, you know, they could have shown her bouncing ideas. Like, do you think we should trust him?
Yeah.
Well, the imp's got this reputation, but on the other hand, I've heard that. And like we could at least be party to that.
Yeah. I wonder if you could resequence events with Grey Worm and Barristan and the Sons of the Harpy and Hisdar and try and get there before they kill Barristan, before the Sons of the Harpy come to a head.
It feels like...
I don't know. I don't want to try and rewrite this thing for him, but...
But it does feel like there is a little bit of tightening of the timeline they could have done, and maybe it's because they are they were introducing so much new material, but I've never felt that in another season, like... You know, you look back at everything and like, oh, you know, they could have maybe moved this around or that around or whatever. But yeah, I feel like that with a few examples, contrary, nothing is a bad or terrible idea. It's just a lot of it felt rushed and not well considered.
Yeah.
Like I have to make a lot more excuses and a lot more headcanon for why things are happening than I've ever had before.
All right. I know going into this season, you were predicting it was going to be the worst.
I did.
And so I think maybe it's coming to fruition.
I think we had some rough riding.
Yeah.
But I'm also super excited about the next two episodes.
Yeah, me too.
Holy shit. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's last feedback. Okay. This has been a super long podcast, but we had a lot of, you know, like I said, you get an episode to start spoiling the books, and I want to talk about it a lot.
Yeah, essentially had double the speculation to do.
We did.
Normally it's just me. This time it's you too.
Twice the speculation. We have to figure out what to do with that.
Yep.
Anyway, if you'd like to send us more feedback, you can do so at gameofthrones@baldmove.com, and you can follow along on our discussions on the forums at forums.baldmove.com. You can also pay attention to our release schedule on Twitter and on Facebook, and of course, baldmove.com. It always works. Check it out. You got all of our latest week or two's worth of releases on the front page. And yeah.
And what's coming up?
What's coming up? We got a coming soon, especially if you're a premium member and you want to see when we're recording these things. When we're doing battle with the lawnmower man and the sweeper lady. Which you don't even know about.
That's right.
That's a whole universe you're not even aware of.
If you're not a premium member, you are missing out on some serious...
Stalling for time while lawnmowers are outside the background.
Serious downtime. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We're going to be back. I'll be back Sunday night after the episode. You'll be back on Friday.
Oh, okay. I was like, Jesus, have I been fired?
No. But you'll be back with a whole lot of spoiler stuff.
Yep.
We'll see. until then, I'm Jim.
I'm Aaron. Bye-bye.